Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about education. Pennsylvania State Representative Jim Roebuck's going to be here to talk about his legislation. We're also going to talk about the real waste, fraud, and abuse in government. Can I say charter schools? Can I say cyber charter schools? Can I say all the money that we're handing away in billboards and radio and TV ads and privatization of education? To me, waste, fraud, and abuse. Also going to talk about voting here in Pennsylvania. We want to rig the game. Other states want to say, you know what, we want to open it up to everyone. Different views, different thoughts, different comments. Also going to talk about debtors' prisons, Wall Street, cheated CPI, and so much more. Your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. You can email me or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So good news today, the good news, road trip. That's right, the Rick Smith Show taking the show to the road. This June, we're going to go start right around the 8th of June, going to head out to California to Netroots Nation in San Jose. And then, of course, we will come back making stops all along the way to highlight what really made this country great, who the people are, the communities, the industries that we, the people, built. And when I came up with this idea several months back, it really came out of the History Channel doing this series, you know, the Men Who Made America Great, or, you know, another one of these series, just, you know, a big sloppy wet kiss to the billionaires, a big sloppy wet kiss to the Carnegies and the Mellons and, you know, the modern day Trump. When you got Donald Trump talking about someone who made the country great, you know, I kind of got to go, nonsense. You know who made this country great? You did. Your parents, your grandparents, the people who got up every day, worked their behinds off, invested in the future, and made a better tomorrow for their kids. That's what made this country great. And when we take off on this bus tour, on this media tour, because, you know, look, at the end of the day, we're fed so much BS, we're fed so much nonsense by the corporate-controlled media. How do you know what's right? You know, I look at all across this country, the stories that should be covered. And we try to get them here on the program because there are so many working class stories, so many working people doing fantastic things that it needs to be highlighted. It needs to be talked about. And it's not. We get infotainment. We get, oh, Jay-Z's going to Cuba. Went to Cuba. Did Obama let him go? Or we get the, oh, you know, the next runaway bride, or, hey, the shiny thing over here. We get distraction. You know, some call it infotainment. I don't even think it's that, because I don't even know that there's information there. And you look at, and this is what drove me to start this program years ago. I, as a union member for years, used to volunteer time to do things with my union, with other organizations. And I always found that anytime, and this was highlighted really during Katrina, when the local that I was a member of sent their truck down to Louisiana several times. They would take up donations from all the different churches, and they would, at their expense, at the members' expense, drive it down and deliver it. Not one news report that I see ever even show the truck. Not one. They highlighted the church that filled that brought stuff and all the churches that brought stuff, but they never mentioned that, you know, the truck that it went down was a union truck. And those were drivers who had volunteered their time. Never. And you look at this recent study that came out from a professor of media markets at Texas State University, who said, you know, during from 2008 through 2011, less than 0.3% of the news stories that went out over the four major broadcast networks, 0.3% involved labor, the unions, union issues, whatever. 0.3%. And you break it down, you go, well, what were the 0.3%? Well, you know what they were. Anytime there was something negative, anytime there was a conflict, anytime there was a strike, and I would argue that once you probably broke those down, I would argue that, because in my experience of seeing this stuff, it's always against the workers. Because you've got a corporate-controlled media structure. You've got this culture that if it bleeds, it leads. So if there's conflict, especially if there's workers in the street and they're angry and that's what you put on there. And of course you blame it on the workers. Which is why, you know, I go and I think about what needs to happen in this country, and what needs to happen is we need to have an alternative media structure. We need to get more voices out, not less. We don't need more consolidation. We don't need more clear channels and citadels and all of the. We don't need more of that. We don't need more Viacoms. We don't need more of that. We don't need more. I don't know if you saw it. Verizon and Comcast are marrying up, and someone sent me an envelope with Verizon Wireless and Xfinity on the same envelope, which now they're one company, a major, massive conglomerate of media. Are you okay with that? Because I'm not. Which is why I think while we still can, we're going to embark on, at this point, a 20-city tour across this country. Every night in June, we're going to bring our program from wherever we are. And we're going to be talking about those communities, what in that community made that community and this country great. And I think about my hometown. I think of Cleveland, Ohio. It was the steel mills. It was the manufacturing base. It was the auto industry. It was all of that technology, all of that machinist capability, all of that creation, all of that production, all of that sweat, all of that back-breaking work that made this country great. That, you know what? Nobody's going to remember those people's name. History's not going to remember them, but you know who does? The families and the communities. You know, I think of Toledo, Ohio, who right now, today, you know, you think about go back in our history. Toledo, Ohio, today, you know, back in history, was the famed auto light strike, where, you know, thousands of workers took to the streets and said, you know what, we want better wages, we want better hours, we want better conditions, we want a better tomorrow for our kids. And, you know, I look at this and I say, you know, at some point, we need to remember that. 6,000 workers in Toledo back in 1934 took to the streets. It was a five-day running battle. It's what they call the Battle of Toledo. Two workers were killed, 200 injured. Called out the National Guard. And you know what? The workers won. And to me, it's one of those examples of when we stand and fight together, when we know our history and what's going on in this country. The reason I think this is so important, to go back and look at how did my grandparents' generation build the largest middle class in the history of civilization? How did they build a system to where every generation since has done better? Well, until now, we're kind of teetering there. How'd they do that? The right wing of this country, what they're doing is they're systematically dismantling our education system. They have completely taken labor's history out of the schools. They have completely taken workers' struggles out of the schools. And now what you have is you have the History Channel, who does this wonderful series on about Andrew Carnegie, and this wonderful series about all of these robber barons of yesteryear, and how, oh, the country couldn't have been great without them. I disagree. This country couldn't have been great without the thousands and millions of workers who busted their behinds, sacrificed, and built this country brick by brick, stone by stone, steel girder by steel girder. And as we go across this country, we are going to highlight those stories, the true history of this country, the true history of what made our country great. And we're going to take that message to the right-wing airwaves. We're going to take it wherever we can. Because now is the time where we have to be fighting for this stuff. You know, I'd interviewed a guy who was a professor down at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and he had run a Labor Education Center. And it's where they had their history, their archives. It's where they had, you know, the history of Alabama's labor. And because you go, oh, the labor, there's no labor now. Yes, there is. There are workers in every state. It's just that in some states, the laws are rigged against workers. In states like Alabama and South Carolina, where the laws are rigged against them. And the history of labor has been eviscerated, so the workers don't even get to know that. Which is why this is so, why I feel so passionately about this tour, and why I think it's so important that we hear the stories, that we remember the history, that we go back and go, okay, this is what happened. I don't know how many people saw the Rand Paul speech at Howard University, where he basically rewrote the entire civil rights movement in a matter of, you know, a couple of minutes. You know, it was Republicans who did all those wonderful things for civil rights. It wasn't Democrats. What the Democrats did is the Democrats promised you stuff. And that's why black people vote for Democrats, because they got free stuff. I mean, really, is that the argument you're going to make? The reality is the Republicans at the time when they were debating welfare were furious about it. A. Philip Randolph was furious about the welfare program. He wanted what? He wanted a jobs program. Something that I think we should still be talking about, because I don't believe in welfare either. I believe in jobs. But that would then mean that we couldn't divide people. That would mean that we couldn't point our fingers and say it's those people. It's the urbans. It's those 47% who are bringing us down. I'm telling you, folks, we need to come together and come together quickly. Which is why I'm excited about this opportunity to get out into the streets and get out and talk to people. This is the organizing. This is the hard work that needs to be done. If you've got any ideas for our bus tour, we're still in the fluid stage. We've got cities picked out. We've got ideas of where we want to go, what we want to do. But if you've got ideas, we want to make this a communal thing. We want people to say, hey, I've got an idea, or hey, I'd like to help plan something. We would love to hear from you. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I am looking forward to this. Going to take the family on the road trip, and out of it, we're gonna write a book. We're gonna publish videos along the way. All the things that I think need to be done. This is really gonna be something exciting, and I'm really looking forward to it, and love to hear your input. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Pennsylvania State Representative James Roebuck. Stick around.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Immigration is not a crime! Stop the Pentagon! Now's the time!
Thousands of people rallied in Washington, D.C. and around the country this week supporting immigration reform. Labor unions joined dozens of other organizations to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship for an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. With some Republicans supporting reform, immigration reform is now closer than it's ever been. Democratic Philadelphia mayor's veto of paid sick days for workers will stick, at least for now. The Philadelphia City Council is one vote short of being able to override Mayor Michael Nutter's veto of the ordinance that would have legally guaranteed paid sick days for workers in the city. More than 100,000 Philadelphians would have benefited from the ordinance. The City Council has twice passed the paid sick days bill. Yesterday, the House Subcommittee on Workforce Protections heard testimony on the Working Families Flexibility Act. Jesse Russell reports.
The intention of the bill is to provide workers with the option of receiving comp time for working overtime instead of receiving additional pay. The accumulated comp time could then be used by the employee to take time off for family responsibilities. Taking comp time is intended to be voluntary, with employers and employees both signing an agreement. Opponents of the bill say it will undermine the 40-hour work week because it gives too much power to the employer. National Partnership for Women and Families Senior Advisor Judith Lichtman was the sole opponent of the bill called to testify.
An employee who doesn't accept comp time could be penalized with fewer hours, bad shifts, and loss of overtime. And because it's cheaper to provide comp time than to pay overtime wages, there's an incentive for employers to hire fewer people and rely on overtime hours paid for in future comp time to get work done.
She said there are better options being floated in Congress that would help working families.
The Healthy Families Act, which makes earned sick days available to millions. Paid family and medical leave insurance modeled on successful campaigns, programs in California and New Jersey. Expand access to FMLA for more workers for more reasons, so parents really could take time off to attend parent-teacher conferences.
Minnesota State Representative Jason Metza has accepted a Working America challenge to try and live on $7.25 an hour for 5 days. Metza says he can't possibly really know the reality of day-to-day living struggles faced by minimum wage workers, but he says living on that wage for 5 days is an attempt to better understand the economic situation minimum wage workers are in. A bill to raise the minimum wage to $9.95 an hour is being considered in the Minnesota legislature. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Governor, free money. Free markets, my behind. It's free money. That's what it is. In fact, Governor, free money is in Brazil and going to Chile as we speak. With his checkbook wide open. In fact, according to his website, he says he's on this big trade mission to open up opportunities in Pennsylvania. He announced the possibility of creating 74 jobs in Franklin County. He says he's opening up other markets, doing other things. And so look, if you bring 74 jobs, great. But if you're celebrating those 74 possible jobs, my question is, what about the 20,000 teachers and education professionals who've lost their job because of his policies? It's great that he and his wife got to go on a free vacation funded by private interest. That's great. At least we know he's not doing any more damage here in our state. But what about the 950 union workers and the 100 management workers in Erie that work for GE Locomotive who are going to lose their job because GE is planning to flee the state and move to Texas? I haven't heard a peep on that. And in fact, it's his policies who are making things that much worse. And on the education front, we need to get away from these charter schools, and especially these cyber charters and the way we've been funding this, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Jim Roebuck to come talk to us about his proposed legislation. Jim, thanks for taking time for me.
I'm very happy to do that.
So I look at
with you.
Yeah, I look at this governor. He's in, I guess, out of the country now on someone else's dime, which I guess is okay with me, as long as he's not ruining things here. Not doing anything at home. Bringing 74 jobs. We've lost 20,000 education professional jobs over the last 2 years. I got a problem with that.
Well, I think we all should have a problem with that. Certainly, the massive cuts to education hurt all the citizens of the Commonwealth, and most important, I think they make it much more difficult to try to ensure that our young people get the quality education they need upon which they build productive lives. So the implications are longstanding.
You know, we hear right wingers screaming, going, ripping their hair out, hair on fire. There's waste, fraud, and abuse everywhere. Waste, fraud, and abuse. I have found, Jim, a lot of waste, a lot of fraud, and a lot of abuse in the way we fund these charter schools and these cyber charter schools. There's got to be a way to get this money back.
Well, there's got to be a way, certainly, in which state government ensures that they are transparent and that they are accountable for the money they spend. And that's clearly not true now. In the report which I did, which is available to those who might want to look at it, is in calling for reform legislation, we demonstrate that we list out a number of the instances of waste, fraud, and abuse, and it's not just things that aren't from reliable sources. It's based on reports from the Auditor General, from city controller in the city of Philadelphia, those who have responsibility for doing fair assessments and finding out where there are problems. So there is a documented record of the failure of the current charter school law.
How much waste, fraud, and abuse have you identified with the current law?
We estimate that if we were to address the problems that we've identified, we would save in the first year at least $365 million, and that the savings would continue thereafter. We'd be looking at probably at least $100 million every year thereafter. So that it's we talk about there not being enough money to fund public education. Here's a clear area where you can find the money you need, and it doesn't involve raising taxes. It involves holding those who spend public dollars accountable for the way they spend those dollars.
Absolutely. So if I get this right, $365 million every year that we think that we, the taxpayers, me and all of my listeners, we think we're putting into the classroom, into teachers, into books, into computers, into all of the things we need to educate our children, not going to that. Is that what you're telling me?
Not going to that. Not going to that. It's being spent on any number of things double dip on pensions. It's being spent on reserves. It's being spent on building up the reserves that are then diverted to non-educational purposes. So there are any number of problems. It's spent on advertising. Taxpayer dollars being spent on advertising for the charters and the cyber charter schools. Again, it's not going in the classrooms. It's going to build an education business, not to educate children.
Let me ask you, you brought up the advertising, and I hear the ads all the time. I see the billboards, I see the Google ads, I see the ads on the computer, I see all of this telling me how wonderful, especially the cyber charters are, how just fantastic, and how if my daughter's a dancer, the latest one I see, Commonwealth Connections Academy or whatever it is, I hear the ad all the time. My daughter likes to dance, but she doesn't like going to school. It just gets in the way. We found a way where she could dance and go to school, and I'm going, there's a ton of money being spent on that, money that I think should be in the classroom.
Should be and is not in the classroom. You're exactly right.
So I guess the question then becomes, because in the world of business, if you're not advertising, you're dying. If people don't know about you, you're dying. So all I hear is all of these advertisements telling me how wonderful all of these different charter and cyber charter operators are and all of these schemes, how wonderful it is. I'm thinking, what's wrong with my public school? What's wrong with the school down the street from my block? How come I'm not hearing anything about that?
Well, the reality is that those schools are not allowed to use taxpayer dollars to advertise.
Uh-huh.
That's part of the problem. There are laws in place that limit the amount of surplus that they can have. That's not true for charters. So you could build up surpluses and divert that money to other things. So there is, whatever the intent of the original law we wrote in 1997, adopted 1997, the way it has been applied, the way it's being used now, it has produced unintended consequences. We've seen things happen that no one anticipated and things we need to remedy.
Well, so was it unintended? Because, you know, I've talked to people who thought they had a clear vision of where they want. This was the first step towards privatization. This was that first step, you know, the charters, then to the vouchers, and then to a fully private system where government doesn't. I know people who truly thought that this was that first step. And, you know, so this idea that, well, it was unintended consequences, maybe you think that, but I believe there are people who were behind this from the very beginning who plotted this out.
Well, I think that there's certainly those who always believed we needed to, in some way, change the what was then the existing public school system, and I'm not certain that they consciously laid it out as it has developed, but I certainly think that is at the heart of what is happening, is that the intent is to undermine the free public school system we have. And to create a system where you would have different kinds of standards applied, where all teachers would not necessarily have to be certified, where you could do things in different ways. And I think the end result is, rather than improving education, it has not improved education. In some cases, it's actually been detrimental to education for young people.
Because I just don't see how you can run several different systems at the same time with the same or a dwindling pot of money. I just don't see how it's possible. You look at our governor, who's got, what, almost $2 billion, working on the third billion now as we speak in the third year. I don't know how you can cut that kind of money out and then have these overly generous handouts to these cyber charter operators and these charter operators. I just don't see how you can have both without destroying one of them.
And I would fully agree on, and unfortunately I think that certainly the intent seems to be to destroy the public school system. I understand that the way, at least the law was envisioned from its inception, was that you were creating a new way of doing education that would be innovative, and that in fact you could take the innovations that were developed and apply it back to the existing public school system. That has not happened. There's not been a free flow of ideas. There's not been particularly innovative methods or new systems of educating that have developed that you could say charter schools have been a model for building a new type of education that was better than what we have. In many cases, the charter schools are worse than what we have.
Yeah.
The number of charters who have not made AYP, it exceeds the number of the percentages of the traditional public schools. So whatever was envisioned has not become reality. They have not been innovative. They have not been created new ways of doing education or giving our kids opportunities. And particularly the cybers seem to be particularly flawed in an area. None of the cybers made AYP.
Yeah, well, I mean, because you saw the one down in your area, the Frontier Virtual Cyber Charter School,
right,
where they said they were giving out computers and internet access, and they didn't. They just pocketed the money.
And that's documented in part in the report. But also understand what we've done is that the current administration particularly has covered this over in part by setting different standards for evaluating charters. They were assessing the AYP, the measure of school success. They applied a different standard to charters. Further, when we did the new legislation for improving teachers by a new system for evaluating teachers, they specifically excluded charters and cyber charters from that process of evaluation. So whereas your traditional public schools now have in place a system that is designed to evaluate teachers, a more stringent system, charters and cyber charters are not part of that system, although they're supposedly public schools.
Yeah, see, I'm not against the concept of the charter school as it was envisioned from the beginning. I'm not against that.
No, I'm not either.
As long as it's held by we the people, it's held by public interest, and the benefits are to the public. But I look at, and you talked about the idea was you would have a free flow of ideas, and you would have a best practices that you would use. The problem is the best practices and the free flow of ideas was turned into proprietary information that, you know, me as a parent or as a school district, we have to pay for it. I look at these insane tests that we give our kids that are owned by these companies, like these PSSA tests. When I went to go look at the thing, I had to sign a document saying, I will never tell anybody what's on the test, not allowed to talk about tests, because it's proprietary property of somebody. It's not our test. It's not we the people's. It's proprietary. It's owned. And I got a problem with that. I got a problem with my tax dollars developing things that someone else is profiting from.
I think you're very correct in your concern.
So how do we change that? I mean, you know, you look at all of this, and you know, how do we pull back and say, you know, this experiment is failing our kids? Because you know, I go to those 50 some kids that were at the Frontier Virtual Cyber Charter School because their parents said, hey, this might be a great way to get my kids a better education, which I'm not against. But these kids got screwed. They lost a year, two, three, five of their academic career. They're never going to catch back up. How do we fix that?
I think you do that in part by passing the kind of legislation I proposed, which puts stricter measures of accountability, transparency in place, and holds the cyber charter to charter schools, those levels of accountability. That's the first step of things. We need individual parents to be, and the school districts, individual citizens, to be more vigilant, more vocal in demanding that there be policies that are based upon accountability in education. And I don't want to suggest that all of the existing public schools are great and wonderful. I don't suggest that at all. But clearly in this area, we have serious problems that we've identified that we can remedy. We need to do that.
Well, I mean, for me, if there are schools that are struggling, we get in there and we fix those. And we know how to do that. It's called investing in them. It's called properly staffing them, not letting 20,000 education professionals be kicked to the curb. It's called investing in books and technology and making sure that kids have opportunities to get tutors if they need it, extra help on the weekends if they need it. We know how to fix this stuff. And coming up with the latest silver bullet gimmick, not going to do it. When I was a kid, it was busing. Busing's going to save the poor kids' chances at education. And what they do, they bus kids from one side of the city of Cleveland, one poor side of the city, to another poor side of the city, and all you did was switch poor kids around.
That's exactly right. You need what you need to do. We know what works. We know it costs money. We need to spend the necessary money. We need to look at those things that work, and then make sure that we do what we're supposed to do. That's fundamental to anything in terms of improving education.
So let me ask you about your piece of legislation. I understand it's a bipartisan, you've got bipartisan support, more than 40 co-sponsors. What are the chances of it getting through?
I would like to believe there's a good chance, but I'm not, realistically, I would say I'm less concerned that my specific bill gets through, but I think the ideas of that I have articulated, the reforms I've laid out, if it's put into someone else's bill, I don't really care. I think we need the ideas I've articulated, ideas of advance, are what are important. And so I will certainly seek to amend my ideas into any bill that goes through. We can't do what we've been doing, passing legislation, saying this is doing something, saying it's bringing about reform when it doesn't.
Right.
So the key to this is to ensure that whatever we do, we make sure we attack the problem that's there. We know what the problem is.
I'm right there with you. Let me ask you last line of questioning. You brought up AYP a moment ago, and it's my understanding that next year, 2014, the schools that are judged by this classification, 100% of the students who take the test have to pass this test, or the school will be labeled failing, and then you get into that whole structure of taking money away down the road and basically then closing them down and, you know, maybe charterizing them, maybe privatizing them. I'm someone who's saying at this point, the system is broken, the system is rigged. We should just be opting out of it.
I would agree with you. I mean, certainly the hope is that when No Child Left Behind was adopted back at the beginning of the Bush administration was that you would have the necessary resources in place, the necessary funding in place, and we could bring about a major change in the American educational system. That did not happen. And the reality is the implementation of the law has been flawed almost from its inception. The hope that we had has been tainted from the very beginning. So that I would doubt that any district is going to have every student at the level they're supposed to be as we thought they might be by 2014. I would be surprised if you will find very many, if any, district anywhere in the United States where that is true. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't set a goal that is to improve the way we deliver education, and I am convinced that is through strengthening our traditional education system, yep, more than it is to doing things through charters and cyber charters and other kinds of untested reforms.
I'm right there with you. You know how we educate our children? The same way President Obama does with his, the same way Rahm Emanuel does with his kids, the same way Bill Gates would do with his kids. Send them to those kind of schools where they're not burdened with high-stakes testing, where they're not hammered all the time with these data-collecting tests, where we actually have some experiential learning, hands-on stuff, where kids get to explore and actually, oh, I don't know, learn.
And yes, and there are also schools where you have strong teachers who have the necessary support to do what they're trained to do. And that, the fundamental thing is strength of teachers, but also we need to look at strengthening families, because families also are a key element we oftentimes overlook in terms of ensuring that kids learn and that learning or the desire to learn is enforced from the home, carries forward to the school, which brings with respect for learning, respect for teachers, and a determination to do good.
Amen, brother. Go do it. You're the legislature.
I hope I can. I'll do my very best to do that.
James, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you so much. Enjoy.
Thanks so much. Pennsylvania State Representative James Rohrbach. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Razor Tattoos presents Get On Board, an art show to benefit autism. Get On Board features custom, one-of-a-kind artwork on skateboard decks from nationally renowned tattoo artists and fine artists. All proceeds go directly to the Autism Society, Greater Harrisburg area. The initial public showing will be during the Derby, Inc. Invitational Tattoo Convention at the Farm Show Complex, April 19th through 21st. Visit facebook.com/getonboardforautism. That's facebook.com/getonboardforautism. Sponsored by Razor Tattoos.
Here's a scientific conclusion that even a professional science denier would accept. Being stuck in line, on an airplane, in a waiting room, or anywhere else with someone loudly nattering inanities into their cell phone is somewhere between irritating and infuriating. You don't really need a PhD in human psychology to come to this conclusion, but it turns out that quite a few scientists have been conducting research on the obvious, probing the whys behind the annoyance of cell phone chattering. A new study out of San Diego University concludes that two factors are at play here. One is simply the trapped response. You're stuck in a place with this cackling conversation assaulting you, so your stress level quickly builds to a boil. The other is what scientists are calling the half-a-log factor. Unlike hearing two people carry on a conversation, we hear cell phoners yakking with someone who's not there, so we're getting only half of what's being said. Psychologists say that this hijacks an innocent bystander's brain, which can't help but search for some logic in what it's receiving. Thus, our gray cells involuntarily struggle to put the half-a-log into a dialogue, distracting us from our own thoughts or disrupting a simple moment of solitude. Another study found that the brain perceives the one-sided conversation to be abnormally loud, even when it's not. This not only drives us to distraction, but also to a simmering fury, ultimately chauffeuring us right up to the dark precipice of antisocial behavior. This is Jim Hightower saying, as one who has been brought to that edge several times, it seems to me that the people prattling on so rudely are the antisocial ones. I appreciate the recent scientific attention to this uncouth narcissism, but wouldn't it be better to address it at the kindergarten level?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Most of them are not in sympathy with the union. There's a small group in the union and that's typical of an organization like that. And it's typical of a Congress. It's typical of unions. It's typical of companies, I guess. The NRA is another place where the membership, if you do the polling, doesn't agree with the leadership.
What they do, they smile in your face.
that's, you know, they throw that out there all the time. Well, you know, the union bosses, the membership doesn't agree with them. Yeah, the union, the membership does. The membership agrees that they should be paid a reasonable wage with decent benefits, with sick days and a little vacation, a little job security. They agree with that. Absolutely, 100%. And they want labor law. Oh, they want labor law that's going to help. Not to be used against them. And you look what the Republicans are doing, man. They have neutered the National Labor Relations Board, and business is giddy. I mean, that's not even something that Ronald Reagan or George Bush did. This is something that the Republicans have come up with, new idea. Hey, if we can't use it to screw workers, we're going to just neuter it. Just mind blowing. 520 Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Questions on your mind, something, thoughts, anything. You know, this whole education thing, ever since I did my segment last night on why I opted my daughter out of the PSSA, got a slew of messages from people, a lot of support, some, you know, questioning the basic idea because not understanding. And, you know, I got an email from Susan who wrote, you know, I just listened to the opt-out segment. I have a daughter in fifth grade, too. She said it was eerie because she and I, Susan and her daughter, had the exact same conversation that you did. Her daughter told me that her daughter told her that they weren't allowed to discuss anything about the test. Then she cried and hasn't been able to sleep because her teacher told her that if only two people in the class fail the test, their entire class. And then the school failed the test. And she, according to Susan, the daughter believed it. Believed that if she doesn't pass the test, her school is going to fail. She writes, think about all the kids who don't have parents that talk to them about this and how those poor kids fail. She said, all this school reform garbage is getting to be overwhelming. Common Core is another beast that is coming our way. ExxonMobil has an ad campaign promoting Common Core standards, which tells us who is behind the test and why they want kids to take them. And, you know, you look at it, and the reality is it's the big money behind this. And we talked about ExxonMobil's scheme a couple of months back. They were running this, you know, oh, we can't fail thing, and we need to do these corporate things. We need to get education dollars into the hands of the profiteers because they know how to do things. They can run it like an oil company. So when there's a spill, you just kind of quarantine that off. Susan also points out that we need to be talking to our legislators about the waste that is this cyber school funding, much like we talked about with Jim Robuck there a minute ago. And her suggestion is, you know, to talk to people who don't care about education. There are people who just don't care. And they think that these charter schools, because we're going to lower those wages and steal health care and steal benefits, and we're going to get teachers to work for pennies like they used to, and that'll save me tax dollars. It's not. I actually had someone tell me that, well, he wants to privatize the whole system so he doesn't have to pay any taxes, which I'm going, I think you have a misconception, a major, massive, enormous misconception here. You are not going to get away with not paying taxes. It's not going to happen. They're going to make you pay more and more and more so they can profit more and more and more. Look what they've done in the private sector to every other industry. Squeeze wages, squeeze benefits, squeeze every ounce of potential dollar savings out, which means, hey, you know, 50 kids in a class, 60, 70, how many can we squeeze in there? We'll sit kids on each other's laps, more kids, more profit. Because kids will then just be profit motives. They'll be little factors of production, little things that we need to generate revenue. And the cheaper that we can educate them, the more profit from that revenue the profiteers will see. So what she says is what we need to do is we need to make sure that people understand. We're wasting tax dollars giving it to these charter operators. We're wasting tax dollars developing curriculum with public dollars that's supposed to be for public schools that profiteers patent and make their own and then sell it back to us. This is waste, fraud, and abuse at an enormous level. And I think she's right. We need to have people who understand and are articulate out there saying, hey, this is a huge windfall for these big companies. We need to stop it. I mean, for all of those people who say, waste, fraud, and abuse, here it is. right in front of us. Got another email, said, you know, of my decision, good for you. I'm a teacher in the district, applaud your decision. Thank goodness the word is getting out about these tests. She quotes Albert Einstein, who said, not everything can be counted counts, and everything that counts can be counted. So what he said, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. And that makes a lot of sense to me. There are certain things about education that you can't quantify. She also said, your segment last night said that teachers don't administer the test. That's not exactly accurate. They're responsible for administering the test and reporting any infractions, of which there are many. Just wanted to clarify that. Keep up the great work. Thanks so much. Look, they're more like prison guards. You know, and I, when I talk about administering a test, I'm talking about the person who's giving it, who created it, who's going to be grading it, they're instrumental in the entire process. I'm not talking about the person who slaps the booklet down in front of you and then walks up and down like the warden in a prison camp. Talking about like when I was a kid going to school and they took the test of the copy machine and they came back and handed them out and they graded them and they made notes about, hey, this is what you should have done and this is how you need to do this right next time. These tests don't do any of that. So when my daughter tells me that, you know, the teacher that walks up and down the aisles, the principal walks her across the room, and I can't tell you, Dad, I can't tell you anymore because I'm not allowed to talk about what happens in the test, which is absolute nonsense. We've created a prison environment within our public schools, and it's about damn time we break that, which is what we're working on right here, and we're going to continue on this as long as it takes. Until people start taking to the streets and saying, enough already. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Interested in your thoughts. Right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America, but he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
Earth, sky.
Today, what causes the aurora borealis or northern lights?
Some Inuit believed the spirits of their ancestors could be seen dancing in the flickering lights. In Norse mythology, the aurora was a fire bridge to the sky built by the gods.
But science tells us the aurora happens because of the sun. Storms on the sun send gusts of charged solar particles hurling across space. If Earth is in the path of the particle stream, our planet's magnetic field and atmosphere react. When the charged particles from the sun strike atoms and molecules in Earth's atmosphere, they cause them to become excited.
Atoms consist of a central nucleus and a surrounding cloud of electrons. When charged particles from the sun strike atoms in Earth's atmosphere, electrons move to higher energy orbits further away from the nucleus. Then, when an electron moves back to a lower energy orbit, the atoms release light.
And that's what causes an aurora. What happens is similar to what happens in neon signs. Electricity is used to excite the atoms and gases within the glass tubes of these signs. That's why these signs give off their brilliant colors. Oxygen causes the color green. Nitrogen causes blue or red colors. The aurora works on the same principle, but at a far more vast scale.
For more, come to earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Love him the best name. Charlie, you shall bow. Love him the best name.
So on Wednesday, Senator Dalen Leach, Senator Rob Teplitz, spokesperson from the People for the American Way, people from the Democratic Party. They had a press conference in the Capitol Rotunda. The idea was to deliver thousands of petitions to the governor's office. Since our governor's not in his office, he's on a sandy beach somewhere in Rio, which, hey, if you can get it, man, I don't blame him for going. If someone's going to pay, and you're going to pay the gig to go to Rio and see what's there, while the taxpayer is still paying your wages, and you can put it under the guise of, I'm on a diplomatic trip, I'm on a bringing jobs back to PA. See, we brought 74 back. Never mind the thousands that we've lost, but yeah, we brought a couple back. Justifies the trip, right? Anyway, they took thousands of these petitions to the governor's office, telling him, don't sign on to this election scheme. Don't sign on to this vote rigging scheme. There's a system in this country. Don't let Pennsylvania be one of the states that goes against it. We want to do it on a national level. We want to change the rules nationally. That's something I think that needs to be done nationally. But, you know, you look at this, and the Republicans in this state who are pushing this for one reason. This whole, the whole canard that they've come up with, wow, you know, we're giving voice to blah, 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 blah. It's about stealing the election. It's about stealing votes. It's about stealing the presidency. I'm in favor of a popular vote. Always have been. There should never be a president who wins with less than 50% of the vote. Should never happen. Which is why I do believe we should have instant runoff voting. So that you can vote your conscience, and then you can vote, okay, well, if you know, my green guy or my, you know, my libertarian or whatever, my guy doesn't win, my vote still counts. That is voter participation. That, to me, would be a good idea. But you don't hear anything from the Republicans about that, because that would give voters choice, and we don't believe in that. Not at all. I mean, I look at what's going on in Oregon, and now this is, to me, this is the way it should be across the country, what Oregon is talking about doing. Their Secretary of State, Kate Brown, is leading this effort to say, you know what? When you sign up for a driver's license, we're not going to give you a form to say, would you like to vote? Would you like to sign up to vote? We're not going to ask you. You're going to be registered. When you get your driver's license, you are automatically registered to vote. And then the state will send you a card. You'll be registered to vote at the moment that you get your driver's license. You will be unaffiliated. You won't be a Republican or Democrat. You'll be nothing. You'll be unaffiliated. They'll send you a card in the mail. Good way to keep the post office still employed. I'm in favor of that. And then you can choose your party. Choose whatever you want to be. Or you can choose to opt out. You don't want to participate? You want to vote? You can opt out. Go ahead. It's your right as a citizen not to vote. But you're eligible. There are about 500,000 voters in Oregon that are eligible to vote that aren't registered, and they're already in the DMV database. You know who this scares? This scares Republicans. Because most of those people are poor people. Most of those people who are people who would probably struggle to get to the place to register, or struggle to get through the loops and this way, everybody is registered. And I think that should be across the board, across the country. Every citizen should be registered. I've always been a fan of same-day registration. You show up to the polls, you register. I would like to see a week-long voting. Everybody registered, you got an entire week to get there. Everybody can get there in 7 days. You can find 15 minutes, and there wouldn't be 10-hour-long lines. There wouldn't be all of the nonsense that we've seen over the years with this. It would be a seamless, easy process. But we would have to, you know, actually let people vote. And, well, that's bad for Republicans, because they're failed ideology, they're failed ideas, not popular with the masses, popular with the handful, popular with the very wealthy, the well-to-do, and the misguided. I think it'd be a good idea. Something I would love to see somebody here in Pennsylvania propose. What do you think? I mean, I look at it and I go, you know, I want my vote counted. I want everybody to vote. And I go back to the Paul Weyrich quote. We don't want everybody to vote. He was talking to 20,000 Baptist ministers in Texas back in 1980. He said, how many people want everyone to vote? He He said, I don't want everybody to vote. Their leverage goes down when the voting populace goes up. And he was talking about all of the evangelicals and all of the right-wing insaniacs that follow him and listen to the Heritage Foundation and all that. Because they know if they can hold the vote down, and Governor Corbett said the same thing when he ran in 2010. If they could just hold the vote down in Philadelphia, they would win. And they were able to suppress some of the vote. And you look at all the schemes throughout the years to deny people their right to vote. It's really quite remarkable. And what's even more remarkable to me is that we've put up with it. And that there are people who are saying, yes, we should go with these voting rigging schemes. Absolutely. Let's figure out how we can rig the game in our favor. And my problem with that is rigging anything is eventually it swings around. The thing that I like about our system is that it's generally pretty consistent. Now, if we want to change to a national popular vote, which I think it probably should have been anyway, we should have that conversation. And there's a process for which we go through that, because we are a nation of laws. You can't go changing laws to suit you at this moment. And that's what I see this being. This is them going, hey, you know, we've got an ability to consolidate our power. Just like how they use redistricting to consolidate their power. The only reason the Republicans control the House in Washington is because the state legislatures have done a masterful job of gerrymandering the states. Pennsylvania is a perfect example. I mean, Casey won by, what was it, 9? Obama won by, what, 3, 4%? Yet only 5 of the 18 congressional districts went to Democrats, even though the voting turnout was overwhelmingly on the Democratic side. Well, it's because of that creative pencil. They did a nice job of drawing their map and consolidating things. I mean, have you looked at some of these maps? I mean, it's quite creative. There are people who administer the Rorschach test going, wow, that's pretty screwed up stuff. I don't even know what I see there. Just blows the mind. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you go to get our podcast. Stitcher. Remember, the Stitcher app. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I enjoy and answer all of your emails. Going to take a quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Immigration is not a crime! Stop the Pentagon! Now's the time!
Thousands of people rallied in Washington, D.C. and around the country this week supporting immigration reform. Labor unions joined dozens of other organizations to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship for an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. With some Republicans supporting reform, immigration reform is now closer than it's ever been. Democratic Philadelphia mayor's veto of paid sick days for workers will stick, at least for now. The Philadelphia City Council is one vote short of being able to override Mayor Michael Nutter's veto of the ordinance that would have legally guaranteed paid sick days for workers in the city. More than 100,000 Philadelphians would have benefited from the ordinance. The City Council has twice passed the paid sick days bill. Yesterday, the House Subcommittee on Workforce Protections heard testimony on the Working Families Flexibility Act. Jesse Russell reports.
The intention of the bill is to provide workers with the option of receiving comp time for working overtime instead of receiving additional pay. The accumulated comp time could then be used by the employee to take time off for family responsibilities. Taking comp time is intended to be voluntary, with employers and employees both signing an agreement. Opponents of the bill say it will undermine the 40-hour work week because it gives too much power to the employer. National Partnership for Women and Families senior advisor Judith Lichtman was the sole opponent of the bill called to testify.
An employee who doesn't accept comp time could be penalized with fewer hours, bad shifts, and loss of overtime. And because it's cheaper to provide comp time than to pay overtime wages, there's an incentive for employers to hire fewer people and rely on overtime hours paid for in future comp time to get work done.
She said there are better options being floated in Congress that would help working families.
The Healthy Families Act, which makes earned sick days available to millions. Paid family and medical leave insurance modeled on successful campaigns, programs in California and New Jersey. Expand access to FMLA for more workers for more reasons, so parents really could take time off to attend parent-teacher conferences.
Minnesota State Representative Jason Metza has accepted a Working America challenge to try and live on $7.25 an hour for 5 days. Metza says he can't possibly really know the reality of day-to-day living struggles faced by minimum wage workers, but he says living on that wage for 5 days is an attempt to better understand the economic situation minimum wage workers are in. A bill to raise the minimum wage to $9.95 an hour is being considered in the Minnesota legislature. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I've got a golden chance to make my way. And with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
That's what they're selling us with the charters and the privatization, the vouchers, the golden ticket. It's the golden. It's your way, man. We've defunded public education. We've destroyed that. That's gone. That's done. Don't worry about it. You've got this newfangled thing, this wonderful thing. And, of course, we have all these wonderful tests. In fact, you know, we're going to grade teachers based on these tests, and then we're going to have, well, cheating scandals. You know, last week we talked about the thing in Atlanta. Beverly Hall and 34 other people arrested. Massive cheating scandal, a culture of cheating. And you knew at some point it was going to turn around to the apostle of privatization, the apostle of the high priestess of the cheating scandals, the eraser gate in D.C., Michelle Rhee, and that shoe dropped as well. Now the question is what are we going to do about it? But we knew about this cheating, and they did nothing about it. They covered it up. So what are we going to do? Which is why I've asked Peter McPherson, former Capitol Hill Cluster PTA president, someone who knew Mrs. Rhee and the things that she was pulling there. Peter, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
So I look at this scandal in Atlanta, and I'm told it looks almost exactly what went on in D.C. You had these apostles of privatization, these people who thought these tests are wonderful, erasing the wrong answers and putting in the right answers?
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that happened here in D.C. is that, you know, we had a group of people who were brought in, you know, I mean, and I think, you know, had been advocating for, you know, a very radical sort of realignment of education in America's cities, you know, education for America's poor, essentially. And, you know, and the thing is that, it deeply invested in, you know, in proving that, that their ideas worked. And I think that, fundamentally what has happened is that people just, Michelle Rhee, our current chancellor, Kaya Henderson, The Washington Post, which has been one of Michelle Rhee's most ardent supporters, you know, that they all drank the Kool-Aid and, you know, have just chosen to ignore, you know, these, you know, overwhelming evidence, you know, that cheating had taken place because of this desire, you know, to prove that, that their particular educational ideology, you know, was superior.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, when they brought Michelle Rhee in, she had, from what I understand, virtually no experience. And then she ended up surrounding herself with people with virtually no experience. So you have this situation where you have someone with no experience who surrounds herself with these worshipers of this neoliberal privatized education. And what do you think you're going to end up with? You're going to end up with people who I think will do anything to push their ideology forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is that when Michelle Rhee, you know, first arrived on the scene, I mean, you know, she had never been a school principal, had never been a superintendent of a school system of any size, you know, then the president of a, you know, comparatively small nonprofit. So, you know, you had this enormous management, you know, deficit. And, you know, and then it brought in, you know, I remember back in 2008 when I first became the PTA president, I had a meeting with Michelle Rhee down at the DCCS headquarters. And, you know, I remember walking in and, you know, standing there in the lobby, and I'm thinking, Jesus, everybody around here looks like they're 12, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, just incredibly, I mean, a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm, but incredibly young, incredibly inexperienced. You know, and I'll tell you, the fact is Michelle Rhee is gone, but I think that we are still very much reeling from, you know, this is what happens when, you know, you get inexperienced true believers running something, is that, you know, the desire, you know, to prove that they're right, you know, fundamentally starts to outweigh, you know, kind of an honest appraisal of, you know, what you're doing. I mean, whether or not it's working. I mean, these people, Michelle Rhee, Kaya Henderson, the whole crew of them, you know, that they claim to worship data, but, you know, we worship data until we don't.
Right.
That they, you know, that if you ever confront them with something, that data, you know, that really, you know, kind of contradicts what they're getting at, it's just all of a sudden that data doesn't matter, you know. And so, I mean, it's been a very unpleasant environment, frankly. You know, we have I spend a lot of time in schools every day in the District of Columbia. And, teacher morale, you know, is in the toilet. Very unhappy. There's a lot of staff turnover. There's a lot of school leadership turnover. You know, even though the District of Columbia has a budget surplus of $417 million, the school system budget is still being cut, you know. So it's, you know, the whole game also feels very much like it's rigged, you know, in order for, you know, the continued ascendancy of charter schools.
And the whole privatization move. And look, I believe the whole game is rigged. I mean, you go back to 2001 when No Child Left was passed. They set that whole game up specifically to fail. As I understand, next year, in order to meet AYP, average yearly progress, you have to have every student in every class in your school pass that test, or you're a failure.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, that the Obama administration, Arne Duncan, the education secretary, you know, created these waivers, you know, that states can apply for, and the district has applied for one and got one. But, you know, the thing is you get this waiver, these AYP waivers, and there are, you know, they make you jump through a lot of other hoops, you know. And like one of the things that was easy for DC was that, you know, they want you to put into place these very onerous teacher evaluation systems, you know, in which DC is on sort of the cutting edge of that. And, you know, that has been one of the most toxic, events there is because, you know, that, yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I think, you know, this TV scandal, you know, one of the most important motivators behind it is that, you know, the fear on the part of teachers, the fear on the part of principals, and also the willingness of people at the very top to turn a blind eye because, you know, it's like these evaluations, which are very much tied to performance on the tests, you know, that getting a good score is dependent on score growth among your students, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, everything about it, you know, calls whatever results you get every year, to me, suspicious, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I look at this, and I look at the situation in Atlanta, and I wonder if there's a comparison to what went on in D.C. Because, you know, in Atlanta, the way the story is going is it was an entire culture of cheating from the superintendent all the way down to the custodians. And you got to wonder, you know, given this memo that just came out that Michelle Rhee had to know that there was some suspicious things going on and chose to, well, to cover it up.
Oh, I mean, she's lying. I mean, you know, of course she knew. She could say she didn't know. She did know. I mean, there were so many reasons to be suspicious. And, John Merrow's, the work that he did, the reporting he did, you know, I mean, they've got the smoking gun. I mean, they knew, and I just think, you know, that there was a deliberate decision, made to ignore it. And the thing that's happened since then is like, you read the editorial page of the Washington Post, you know, and they'll talk about, you know, the multiple, investigations that, supposedly cleared DCPS, you know, that it wasn't, you know, any kind of conspiracy or scandal wasn't, you know, it wasn't very far reaching. But the thing is all of those investigations, have been compromised right out of the gate.
Right.
Because, you know, that either they were limited to a very small number of schools, I mean, far, far lower than the ones that were, you know, identified in the initial reporting that USA Today did. And, you're looking at either a small number of schools or the investigations have been set up so that only a small number of people are interviewed or they're only interviewed with people from the school system present. And so, you know, there has never been an honest, you know, let's have the disinfected and sunlight in kind of investigation to, you know, to really have a true reckoning with what took place.
Kind of like what they did in Atlanta. I mean, I look at what they did in Atlanta, and the original reports, as I found it, said that, you know, they had found cheating in almost 79% of the schools that they looked at. And originally, they had implicated, I think it was 178 principals, teachers, a whole slew of people. They really went through it. And as I'm reading the story, they left no stone unturned. And I look at what they've done in D.C., and as you pointed out, they haven't done that. So there hasn't been a real investigation. And if you really wanted to put students first, don't you think an investigation should be done?
Well, yeah, and I mean, this to me is one of the saddest aspects of all of this, because, you know, when Michelle Rhee first came to town, you know, it was, you know, and after she left D.C., after her time as chancellor ended, you know, going on the Oprah Winfrey show and talking about, you know, I'm going to start a revolution, you know, with Bank of America's children. But, you know, the thing is that fundamentally what has happened in the past 5 years is about grown-ups and the needs of grown-ups, whether it's, you know, the need of Michelle Rhee to prove that, her ideas can work, or a teacher who doesn't want to get fired, or a principal who doesn't want to get fired, or, you know, a rich philanthropy like the Walton Foundation, you know, wanting to, you know, being ideologically invested in, you know, the positive outcome in Washington. It has ended up being about adults, about the needs of adults and children and the kids in this city, the ones who need a good school system, you know, are some of the most disadvantaged in the United States, you know, and they need a school system, and they have deserved a school system that is approaching their needs, with honesty and with, you know, just a simple focus on what the kids need.
Yep.
And it hasn't been about the kids. It's been about the grown-ups.
Yeah, and if the teachers are cheating, what's that? What kind of message is that sending to the kids? Because I look at the tests that these kids, you know, turned in, the erasing happening. They erase the wrong answers, put the right ones in. And, you know, they argue that tests have a diagnostic nature, meaning that the kids, if they fail, they'll get remedial help. that function of that destroyed, as you've said, by adults.
Well, you know, what has been really interesting was my daughter went to a middle school that was a feeder school for one of the elementary school that was under suspicion, you know. And the thing is that these kids would come into my daughter's middle school, you know, from the school where they were supposedly going great guns, you know, and the scores had increased so dramatically. But the thing is that once they got into this middle school, I mean, they were a real handful for the staff at the middle school.
Yeah, because
they just weren't prepared.
Exactly.
And they certainly weren't prepared at a level that their test scores would indicate that they should be. And so the thing was is that the teachers at the middle school that my daughter went to, who played by the rules, you know, who didn't cheat, you know, they got dinged, you know, it hurt them professionally because, you know, the kids who came from this other school weren't doing as well once they were there.
The reason is that
the scores that they came into the school with were not a true, reflection of, you know, where they were really at.
So let me ask you last line of questioning then. Where do you see this going? I mean, you were a part of this system. Do you see a full investigation happening? Do we see the rising star of Michelle Rhee hitting the basement, or do the money interests spin this away?
Well, I mean, you know, I think one of the problems is that if people are going to jail in Atlanta, you know, or at least being arrested in Atlanta and being prosecuted, you know, I just think that, that you really need a true, honest investigation. I mean, maybe by the U.S. Attorney here in the District of Columbia. I mean, the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, conducted one of the suspect investigations. So I think you need somebody, you know, to come in and investigate who will investigate this in a kind of a law enforcement type manner, you know, with subpoenas, where people are interviewed under oath before grand juries, you know.
Yep,
and
right
I think
there.
That the only place that's going to come from is the United States Department of Justice. I mean, I just think, you know, the city's had its chance to investigate this thing properly itself, and has failed to do so. And the U.S. attorney here in D.C. is very independently minded, and I would think that there's a decent chance, you know, that he'll pick up a gauntlet and carry it. I certainly hope that he does.
I hope so, too, because, you know, if you've got this cancer invading the Atlanta schools and the D.C. schools, you know, no school is safe. And that's just the bottom line. Peter McPherson, I appreciate the time. Thanks for your thoughts.
No, thank you very much for having me. You have a good evening.
You too. Peter McPherson is former Capitol Hill Cluster PTA president. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, on the talk.
One of these days we want to wake up.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but know They're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Here's a scientific conclusion that even a professional science denier would accept. Being stuck in line, on an airplane, in a waiting room, or anywhere else with someone loudly nattering inanities into their cell phone is somewhere between irritating and infuriating. You don't really need a PhD in human psychology to come to this conclusion, but it turns out that quite a few scientists have been conducting research on the obvious, probing the whys behind the annoyance of cell phone chattering. A new study out of San Diego University concludes that two factors are at play here. One is simply the trapped response. You're stuck in a place with this cackling conversation assaulting you, so your stress level quickly builds to a boil. The other is what scientists are calling the half-a-log factor. Unlike hearing two people carry on a conversation, we hear cell phoners yakking with someone who's not there, so we're getting only half of what's being said. Psychologists say that this hijacks an innocent bystander's brain, which can't help but search for some logic in what it's receiving. Thus, our gray cells involuntarily struggle to put the half-a-log into a dialogue, distracting us from our own thoughts or disrupting a simple moment of solitude. Another study found that the brain perceives the one-sided conversation to be abnormally loud, even when it's not. This not only drives us to distraction, but also to a simmering fury, ultimately chauffeuring us right up to the dark precipice of antisocial behavior. This is Jim Hightower saying, as one who's been brought to that edge several times, it seems to me that the people prattling on so rudely are the antisocial ones. I appreciate the recent scientific attention to this uncouth narcissism, but wouldn't it be better to address it at the kindergarten level?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download it there. Get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, you look at the state of education. I got to be honest with you. I look at this, and it is just infuriating. What we have seen happen over the last several years, all in the name of and I love this. It's reform, Rick. Don't you know? We're reforming it so it works better. You know, we're gonna reform it so it works better, right? Yeah, right. We're gonna defund it. We're going to do it. We're gonna heap it with massive mandates. We're gonna do all of these things to make sure that it fails so we can say, see, look, it doesn't work. It fails. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day and I said, you know, I don't remember as a kid hearing anything about my school that would say that it was failing. Yet all I hear now, The only words I hear is, well, we got failing schools. And I'm going, really? When did that happen? We've got schools who've got some problems. And we could probably fix those if we, had the will, had the political will, had the smarts, just a thought. And I look at this and I say, you know, at some point, we need to stand up and say, well, no more. And I look at what's happened to education as a whole from the beginning. And the fact that, you know, the class of 2013, and we talked about this last night, the class of 2013, they're basically screwed. Because, well, they're saddled with massive amounts of debt. The opportunity for a job into the near future, not very great, not very good. And, you know, you think about all of the opportunity that's lost by not being able to get a decent job out of college, having these massive debts. And we've done this to this generation. I saw a report, you know, since 2007, We've seen the federal student loan debt, the combined and federal student loan debt, double since 2007 to $1.1 trillion. $1.1 trillion in this education bubble that's ballooned up. And what we've done is we've allowed the higher ed to be privatized and, of course, profitized. And you look at all of this money that goes into this, and it's mind-blowing. And Bloomberg News did a story on the American dream that is eluding students because of their debt burden. And they say, look, you know what? You've got this professor at Texas A&M. Who graduated a couple of years ago. He's, 35 years old, has a PhD. You know, he's a bright guy. He's got $125,000 in student loan debt, saddled with $125,000. He can't get a mortgage, so he's stuck renting. And then you think about it, this is just one example. So you got this one guy, this one college graduate, who has this massive debt. He can get nothing else. He cannot get a loan to buy a house. He says he can't even get a loan to buy a car. And understand that 2/3 of all student loans are held by people under 40 years old. So you've got this entire generation saddled with this debt. What drives our economy? And we hear this a lot. During the Bush years, we heard every year that he was president, home ownership is an all-time high. Why? Because home ownership drives our economy. Understand that. Because when you buy a house, anybody who's bought a house, and I'm among that crew, what's the first thing you do? Well, you buy the house, and you got to buy a lawnmower because you got to cut the damn grass. Then you buy a weed whacker, and then you buy a stove and a refrigerator. You got to have that. You got to have a washer and a dryer. You got to have a lot of stuff. You start buying furniture. You start buying patio furniture, gas grill. Start buying all kinds of stuff. You are a consumer. You're buying stuff. That helps grow the economy. So now if you've got a whole bunch of people under 40 saddled with a massive amount of debt, what do you think they're doing? Well, they're still sitting in the apartment. Because that's all they can get. And, of course, when you've got all of these people who are in apartments, in rental units, what happens to the cost of rental units? You got it. They go up. So while you've got this generation who's basically stagnant, they're stuck where they are. A lot of them living at home. What's that going to mean for 20, 30 years down the road when these people have nothing to retire on? Because I was just watching Jack Lew testify last night when I got home on C-SPAN about, we need to get the younger generation to start saving earlier. And we need to get them to have little accounts so that there are credit unions and small banks and they'll be happy to take their business. Well, okay, let's say that's true, and it is. The earlier you start saving, obviously, the longer you have to save and the better off you're going to be. But you've got this generation now who's saddled with all this debt. How are they going to save? And now you've got this chain CPI, which is saying lower Social Security benefits. How are they going to retire? I mean, that's the thing that gets me. At some point, we've got to wake up to the reality that we have screwed this generation, and there's got to be some way for debt forgiveness, some way to say, okay, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever, you'll make a percentage, and then we're going to forgive it. Because we should have been investing in education all along. We should have been doing what we've done in the past. But no, for purely profit reasons, we've saddled this generation with massive debt purely because the bankers and the financiers run this country. And there's something seriously wrong with that. Gonna take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Save the USA and resume the tax advice. Stop taking all our money. Shipping it offshore to the job you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, what causes the aurora borealis, or northern lights?
Some Inuit believed the spirits of their ancestors could be seen dancing in the flickering lights. In Norse mythology, the aurora was a fire bridge to the sky built by the gods.
But science tells us the aurora happens because of the sun. Storms on the sun send gusts of charged solar particles hurling across space. If Earth is in the path of the particle stream, our planet's magnetic field and atmosphere react. When the charged particles from the sun strike atoms and molecules in Earth's atmosphere, they cause them to become excited.
Atoms consist of a central nucleus and a surrounding cloud of electrons. When charged particles from the sun strike atoms in Earth's atmosphere, electrons move to higher energy orbits further away from the nucleus. Then, when an electron moves back to a lower energy orbit, the atoms release light.
And that's what causes an aurora. What happens is similar to what happens in neon signs. Electricity is used to excite the atoms and gases within the glass tubes of these signs. That's why these signs give off their brilliant colors. Oxygen causes the color green. Nitrogen causes blue or red colors. The aurora works on the same principle, but at a far more vast scale.
For more, come to EarthSky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed.
Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Our quote of the day comes from Dan Kerbick. He's writing in the New Economic Perspectives, the title, Where Are We Now? He says, the plutocracy has learned something important from the collapse of 2008 and its aftermath. He says, if you can cause a depression, if you loot and exploit the vulnerable to enrich yourselves while spreading the gap between the rich and poor, and if you are even to go so far as to steal the homes and other assets of your victims in broad daylight, then mainstream parties of the contemporary West will do nothing to stop you. And it's exactly what's going on. Both parties, I believe, are complicit in letting these criminals off the hook. You look at the testimony yesterday, Senator Warren asking questions. Are we going to have any information about the illegal activities? Well, we haven't decided. Don't know yet. Mind-blowing. Anyway, the question is are we doing enough? Which is why I've asked Mike Consul, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's written a piece, Is It Already Time to Weaken Dodd-Frank, over at the Washington Post. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, man.
So I guess the question is it time? Should we just do away with Dodd-Frank? Go back to the wild, wild west of finance?
I'm going to encourage your listeners to sit down before I answer this, but I'm going to shock them by saying no. now is not the time to give the bankers a free check to do whatever they want, to violate numerous state, local, and federal laws, force illegal foreclosures, devastate neighborhoods, devastate municipalities, their budgets, their schools, by forcing through these illegal foreclosures that they don't have the documents for, that they're often violating state, federal laws. It's against the law to foreclose on a serviceman overseas without jumping through a bunch of hoops, which they did not try to do. And it's certainly not time to just throw away the derivatives laws like a lot of, like a bipartisan effort in the House has started to grow up around.
Oh, come on, Mike. They learned their lesson. They won't do it again. They promise. I heard Jamie Dimon say, you know, we'll try not to do this in the future. We promise.
And it's funny because the things we're asking them to do are not draconian, right? Like if we were like doing some sort of like crazy scheme that was overwhelming and like some sort of like weird Soviet central planning type of regulations, then I would totally understand it. The thing that Elizabeth Warren specifically was bringing up was just follow the basic laws of how to foreclose on someone. Foreclosing on someone is a really violent and devastating act, and we want to make sure there aren't just basic protections.
Yep.
The U.S. law is not super favorable to debtors. I don't want to shock anyone. Our bankruptcy laws, especially after the 2005 quote-unquote reforms, are really harsh on debtors. And the really shocking stuff is the banks aren't even going to follow the basic minor laws that we have around these things.
And, if you want to fight the banks, good luck on that one. They come in with the power of the gun.
And it's funny. So to catch your listeners up to speed, there's a huge investigation about robo-signing and the idea that the banks were just basically not following basic procedures on how to do the number of foreclosures that have gone through and, in fact, may have been putting through foreclosures that they could have avoided in order to make little profits for themselves but destroy a lot of value for investors and homeowners. And so the OCC, which is the banking regulator, and the Federal Reserve, which also functions as a banking regulator as well, did a big investigation. And Congress, Elizabeth Warren said, you know, can you share with us those results? We're actually writing, the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is writing new regulations about this stuff. So, like, it's a really relevant concern how bad, like, what their investigation found. Because it was said that they found some bad stuff. And so, like, can you give us numbers? Can you give us examples? Can you give us names? And they said that they're not going to. The reason that they gave is because it's a trade secret. Which, if you could imagine...
A trade secret?
Yeah, a trade secret. Like there are foreclosure practices which may be like have a lot of illegal.
Yeah, I mean it's illegal. So that's a trade secret. We're breaking the law. We don't want you to know.
Right, it's like the mafia explaining like their drug, like their money laundering is a trade secret. Like if it's illegal, it can't be a trade secret. It's crazy.
But Mike,
and they're not sharing it.
But Mike, these are people. These aren't corporations because people, corporations are people, my friend, and they have Fifth Amendment rights like any person, like you and me. So they don't have to tell, right?
Well, they certainly have rights, and like we've bent over backwards to make sure that they did not collapse in the financial crisis. But look, I mean, there are basic regulatory processes that should be investigated. And if it comes to that, if they are going to do the equivalent of lawyer up, if that's what they want to invoke, then we need a really serious criminal investigation, which we are not getting from the Treasury Department. The Treasury's the IG at the Treasury has not investigated this stuff, even though it reeks of criminality. I mean, I think it's a real serious problem because it's terrible for people. It's terrible for neighborhoods. It's also really wrecking our economy. I mean, there's a lot of studies that show there's a huge wave of foreclosures and the really still weak, right? I mean, like it's starting to help recover a bit, but the still fundamentally weak housing market is really holding our economy in check.
Yeah, and the reality is I don't think you're going to get anything out of Treasury because Jack Lew is a Wall Street guy from the word go.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it has to come. I mean, it's helpful that the banks are still shocking our conscience, like, so much that, like, you know, things like this where they're not even bothering to try to throw someone under the bus in order to, like, protect the main business means that Congress can still get very angry about it because, you know, Congress gives the OCC power, gives Federal Reserve power to go investigate these things. And if they're going to try to fight them on what they find, especially if what they find is directly harming our country this way, it is both shocking and just basic inappropriateness. So I'm hoping you're seeing Maxine Waters in the House starting to push forward about the way the consultants were hired in this and the way the IG is not responding. I think you're going to see a lot more from Senator Warren, who is just doing a fantastic job as a senator right out the door and bringing real accountability for working class families. And hopefully maybe just the fact that there's so much anger about this might get a little bit of traction, even if the White House gets in the way of it.
Yeah, I'm hoping, and I'm glad to see that. This is one of those things, one of those moments where you're kind of glad that the Republicans blocked her nomination to the CFTC, to the position. I forget the name of it off the top of my head.
The CFTB, isn't it crazy? Because she's like become way more powerful. She's Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, and so I guess the question then becomes is, you know, I see all of this pushing, and it's Republicans and some Democrats to weaken Dodd-Frank, even though because I'm one of the people who say, let's go back to what used to work, that Glass-Steagall thing. That seemed to work pretty well for about 70 years, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like we had a genuine system of regulations, and then there was also the presumption that the banks would follow it. And now, not everyone was a good character, and I'm not trying to romanticize anything, but like there was a general like contract that understood like, you know, you have to follow the rules. I mean, we've been in situations where we make rules and then nobody follows them, and that's sort of what's happening in the financial sector, even after Dodd-Frank, even after the collapse, even after TARP and the bailouts. And that just can't stand. Like, you can't even have a weak regulatory regime if the regulators are going to fight disclosures of illegal activities and the banks are going to show no interest in complying.
And the other thing that you look at this derivatives market and you look at these derivatives I remember going back before the recession hit, Alan Greenspan was asked about them and asked why they weren't regulated. He said they're just such complex financial instruments. You couldn't possibly regulate them, because it's up to the free market. And you look at this and you go, we're still doing really virtually nothing to rein this stuff in. And it's something that Warren Buffett has called, you know, basically a financial weapon of mass destruction.
And it's crazy because what's happening is the House Agriculture Committee, which because of the long historical relationship between corn and food commodities and derivative contracts, has a lot of jurisdiction here. But they're not like Wall Street sophisticated, so Wall Street gives them some money and they pass bills, whatever they like Wall Street wants. Crucially, so Dodd-Frank's brought a lot of derivatives reforms. But, you know, the regulators are writing these rules and essentially they said, If you are a very complex company that has a lot of like subsidiaries, you can do derivatives internally if you follow these small rules and will exempt a bunch of stuff anyway. And then crucially also in the other dimension, if you're a big company in many countries and you want to do derivatives across countries, you have to follow the United States rules if you're a United States company. And so basically like the rules are super friendly anyway. Like, you know, Dodd-Frank says write these rules and they write the rules. And the rules are like, they're really deferential. They took in a lot of comments from the financial sector. They said, you know, we're going to work really hard to make sure this isn't a huge burden on you, right? And you know what they do? They turn it around and they say, you know, we don't even want to follow those weak rules. Congress, can you repeal that? Like that's actually what's happening there.
Yeah.
So it's not just that like they don't want to follow a lot of rules. They don't want to follow any rules.
Yeah, and then again, you want to go back to the wild, wild west of the financial markets. And I got to be honest with you, I'm frustrated on so many levels because here we are, you know, how many years removed from the Bush recession, and still the same things that caused it are possible again.
Yeah, I mean, and this is why the servicing stuff and what Elizabeth Warren is pushing on is because that's the housing market, and that's the system that, you know, gives people loans that trick them, or they give them loans that explode, or give them loans that are just junk, and then, you know, makes it very difficult for them to deal with. I mean, these are like, these aren't the complex, difficult questions like, how do we put a large bank into bankruptcy? Like, how do we really end too big to fail? Like, those are like really tough, abstract questions that require a lot of effort, but like, follow basic criminal law when it comes to foreclosures is not a difficult question.
Nope.
And the fact that we're not getting traction there is really, really bad.
No, I mean, because to be honest, I would like to see a whole bunch of perp walks. I'd like to see a lot of these people who did this. You know, and I know it's never going to happen. I know, you know, the statute of limitations is probably well up on this. But I'd like to see the people who caused all of this strife, all of this grief, all of these lost of these foreclosed homes, all of the pension funds that have been slashed in half. I'd like to see those people, you know, guests of the state.
Yeah, I mean, you need some. You need either to like impose real discipline on what happened, or you need to regulate in such a way that is to make sure it doesn't happen going forward. And the way the financial sector is fighting is, like, obviously they don't, nobody wants to go to jail or take losses on what happened, but they also don't want to say, hey, we screwed up. Let's sit down and make a real system of rules to guide our behavior so we're not tempted to, like, cheat and steal in the future. And they're fighting the basic efforts of that, and that's just really monstrous when you think about it.
Well, let me ask you this, Mike, because, you know, I go back to that Greenspan comment that, you know, the federal regulators, they're just not smart enough to regulate these industries. So the argument is that, well, they couldn't, we can't pass these laws because the regulators couldn't possibly keep up with it. And I see today that the announcement that I saw was this guy who is, you know, one of these, an executive of one of these high frequency trading firms has been interviewed for a spot with the SEC, and, you know, saying, well, we need to bring in this guy who's this expert. And there's part of me that goes, this is part of that swinging door that's created this culture that, you know, you go, you regulate your buddies and let them get away with a bunch of stuff, and then you go right back in and you kind of switch chairs, and it's all this back slapping, hey, we're going to get rich and screw everybody else mentality that's kind of taken us down.
Yeah, and it's really frustrating because we need to have a serious conversation about high-frequency trading and the value it adds, whether or not it's the value is essentially being able to rip off by, you know, coming in front of grandma trying to, you know, manage her 401k a millisecond before she's able to execute the full trade. Like, that just doesn't set a good precedent. I mean, like, that's just, you end up in a situation where the median is going to be so much in stack, like the average voice inside the regulatory agency is going to be so stacked in favor that the balance is going to be entirely off. I mean, I think there's a role for high frequency trading, but I think we need to be very careful about it. And crucially, we're not going to get good rules if we have things like this.
Yeah, I'm with you. Mike, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Mike Counsell, he's written the piece, Is It Time to Weaken Dodd-Frank, published in the Washington Post. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Razor Tattoos presents Get On Board, an art show to benefit autism. Get On Board features custom, one-of-a-kind artwork on skateboard decks from nationally renowned tattoo artists and fine artists. All proceeds go directly to the Autism Society, Greater Harrisburg area. The initial public showing will be during the Derby Inc. Invitational Tattoo Convention at the Farm Show Complex, April 19th through 21st. Visit facebook.com/getonboardforautism. That's facebook.com/getonboardforautism, sponsored by Razor Tattoos.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America, but he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
And you know, it's the sandwich comes in, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Questions, comments, something on your mind. So, you know, this guy, Chris Concannon, he's an executive at the high frequency trading firm Virtue Financial LLC. Evidently had a meeting on the 10th with the new SEC chairman, Mary Jo White. The idea was, I guess, you know, to discuss, hey, I need to bring people in who know this high frequency trading, need to bring, you know, folks in to figure out, and I'm hoping this is the mentality behind it. You're going to bring someone in who knows it and who's willing to say, this is how it should be regulated, to rein it in, to make sure it doesn't become the beast that we've seen it. And with these flash crashes, where the computer just, oops, computer glitch, and boom, you know, granny loses her pension. What I found interesting about the Bloomberg article is in the 90s, you know, going back to that swinging door thing, this guy, Chris Concannon, worked at the SEC in the very same division that monitors exchanges, brokerages, and these in dark pools, where prices aren't publicly displayed. And then he became a partner and an executive vice president at this company. Nice swinging door. He's made probably a nice ton of money. Now, part of me goes, okay, I understand bringing someone like this in, someone who knows intimately the business, who's figured out, who knows all the loopholes, especially when you're talking about a division of regulatory agents that are typically lawyers and don't have trading experience. I kind of get that. But there's also part of me that says, you know, that swinging door, that back and forth, you know, is this guy really going to be the one who says, you know, this is what's really wrong, this is how we rein it in? Or is he going to say, well, this is how we can expand it? And there's two different ways of looking at this stuff. And what worries me is that we've created these games where, as Mike said, you know, we're business friendly as hell. There are very light regulations on corporations, especially if you look in past years. So I hear Republicans running around with their hairs on fire screaming, onerous regulations, Again, same thing with taxes. Onerous taxes, it's great, it's killing us. When you go back, you know, just 20 years, 30 years, go back to the Reagan years, go back to the Nixon years, go back to the Eisenhower years, things were much more regulated. Tax rates were much higher. And you know what? Businesses still profited. Businesses still worked. Think about that for a second. I mean, it's amazing to me. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, like the magical screen. It's amazing. So I look at this swinging door and I go, you know, man, there's some serious problems here. And I guess it comes down to us. It comes down to us, the voters. And you know, I look at Obama and look, I voted for the guy twice. He would not have been my choice of the entire field back in 2008. I would have liked to have seen John Edwards, but you know, here the reality is, if John Edwards would have been the guy, he'd have been torpedoed with his, I'm sure with his scandals. But I wanted somebody who was on the right page. I mean, Obama said a lot of the right things, and I said from the beginning, I thought, you know, he was going to go the way of the wind. And I look at, you know, the chain CPI thing. I look at this business-friendly nonsense, and I don't know how much more business-friendly we have to be. How much more deregulation, how much more taking on of the risk and the burden do we have to do? You know, I love this. I love the right-wing argument. Oh, Obama's a socialist. Yeah, for business, you bet your behind he is. For you and me, not so much. Because I'd love somebody to argue with me about, well, he's a socialist. The guy who's talking about cutting Social Security benefits? A socialist? Really? Can you, with a straight face, make a cogent argument on that point? And the answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. Sad, sad stuff. Got an email during the break from Randall. He says, recently Democrats tried to claw some of the overseas jobs back, but Republicans filibustered the bill in the U.S. Senate. He says the U.S. still pays corporations to ship jobs overseas. Yeah. And think about the perverse incentive in that. I mean, you know, I'm where I live in Carlisle, they're in the process of tearing down what had been a major employer in the area for 93 years. And in just a couple of days, they've basically torn down this entire factory that employed hundreds of people for 93 years. In just a couple of days, it's going to be gone. And, you know, I was thinking about it today. You know, that to me right there, what's going on, that's economic terrorism. What they've allowed to happen. And look, you know, as Randall points out, you know, we're trying to claw some of the jobs back from overseas. I'm of the mindset, you know, fine, we've set it up to where we're competing with the rest of the world, and we've given preferential treatment to companies leaving the country, but we've been doing the same thing across state borders for years as well. At some point, I think Congress has got to use the Commerce Clause to say, hey, no more beggar thy neighbor. No more stealing from each other and using tax dollars to do it. Because Carlisle Tire and Wheel, 93 years in the community, moves to Tennessee. Why? Well, because the state of Tennessee gave them a boatload of cash. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't blame any business for doing that. I just don't. If someone's going to give you a boatload of cash to move your business and you're still going to be able to produce your product, and now you got a whole boatload of cash, you'd be an idiot not to do it. Here's the problem, though. The idiot, us, for allowing a system that promotes that. We're the idiots in this. We're the idiots who keep voting for people who say, oh, yeah, we want to keep those tax breaks for corporations who move to China. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good idea. We should do that more often. Especially when you look at our trade deficit with China. I mean, it's absolutely through the roof. But here again, we don't want to talk about that. We don't want to talk about the fact that just in goods alone, we had a $315 billion trade deficit with China last year. We don't want to talk about that. We don't want to talk about the currency manipulation. We don't want to talk about that. No. We want to talk about Jay-Z going to Cuba. We want to talk about Beyonce. Yeah, that's what we really want to talk about. It's nonsense. We're being screwed over at every turn. And we're being pitted against each other in the name of competition, Rick, don't you know? Yeah. I guess if you tell yourself that enough, you might believe it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you get our podcast. Or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. As always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally, and I look forward to some input, some feedback, some thoughts about our big road tour as we're taking the program across the country. Going to stop at states all along the way and highlight the fact that, you know what? We, you, me, we the people made this country great. Quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Immigration is not a crime! Stop the Pentagon! Now's the time!
Thousands of people rallied in Washington, D.C. and around the country this week supporting immigration reform. Labor unions joined dozens of other organizations to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship for an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. With some Republicans supporting reform, immigration reform is now closer than it's ever been. Democratic Philadelphia mayor's veto of paid sick days for workers will stick, at least for now. The Philadelphia City Council is one vote short of being able to override Mayor Michael Nutter's veto of the ordinance that would have legally guaranteed paid sick days for workers in the city.
More than 100,000 Philadelphians would have benefited from the ordinance. The city council has twice passed the paid sick days bill. Yesterday, the House Subcommittee on Workforce Protections heard testimony on the Working Families Flexibility Act. Jesse Russell reports.
The intention of the bill is to provide workers with the option of receiving comp time for working overtime instead of receiving additional pay. Accumulated comp time could then be used by the employee to take time off for family responsibilities. Taking comp time is intended to be voluntary, with employers and employees both signing an agreement. Opponents of the bill say it will undermine the 40-hour work week because it gives too much power to the employer. National Partnership for Women and Families senior advisor Judith Lichtman was the sole opponent of the bill called to testify.
An employee who doesn't accept comp time could be penalized with fewer hours, bad shifts, and loss of overtime. And because it's cheaper to provide comp time than to pay overtime wages, there's an incentive for employers to hire fewer people and rely on overtime hours paid for in future comp time to get work done.
She said there are better options being floated in Congress that would help working families.
The Healthy Families Act, which makes earned sick days available to millions. Paid family and medical leave insurance modeled on successful campaigns, programs in California and New Jersey. Expand access to FMLA for more workers for more reasons, so parents really could take time off to attend parent-teacher conferences.
Minnesota State Representative Jason Metza has accepted a Working America challenge to try and live on $7.25 an hour for 5 days. Metza says he can't possibly really know the reality of day-to-day living struggles faced by minimum wage workers, but he says living on that wage for 5 days is an attempt to better understand the economic situation minimum wage workers are in. A bill to raise the minimum wage to $9.95 an hour is being considered in the Minnesota legislature. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Mr. President, do you see a major difference between the two of you on Social Security?
You know, I suspect that on Social Security, we've got a somewhat similar position. Social Security is structurally sound. It's going to have to be tweaked the way it was by Ronald Reagan and Democratic Speaker Tip O'Neill. But the basic structure is sound.
Tweaked a little bit. Just tweaked a little bit. So we come up with this idea, this chained CPI. It's, it sounds real technical. Oh, this is, it's a benefit cut. Pure and simple. It doesn't get any simpler than that. It means my grandmother. It means me when I retire. It means you when we get to retirement age. It means less benefit. So this whole idea that we're saving money, I'm kind of confused on, because it's basically stealing from me. It's stealing from every worker who gets to that magical age. But we're saving. Yay, saving. Just blows the mind. Our good friend Richard Eskow over at the Campaign for America's Future wrote a good piece on this, 10 chain CPI facts the White House doesn't want you to know. I thought, you know, this is important. We need to be talking about what this mythical thing, chain CPI, is, which is why I've asked Richard to come talk to us. Richard, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, always a pleasure.
So, chained CPI, sounds real, real complicated.
Well, you know, it's not. They make it sound complicated, but really what it is your Social Security benefit and mine includes a formula so that it keeps up with the cost of living. That's part of the benefit. So, what they're proposing to do here, a lot of good economists, smart economists, think that way that they calculate that increase already doesn't keep up with how much it costs to be old or disabled in this country, and they want to cut it even more. Now, that's a benefit cut, because in real dollars, as you know, as inflation goes up, you're getting less and less every year already, and you'll be getting a lot less under this plan.
So, because when people start to hear that, well, you're cutting benefits, you're taking money away. This isn't taking money away. It's just allowing inflation to eat it away, correct?
Well, yes. I mean, it's taking money away in what they call real dollars, meaning when you adjust for inflation. So, you know, just to keep up with inflation, they might have to kick it up $100 next year, and now they'd kick it up $75, and with this they might kick it up $25 or $50. Those numbers aren't right, but that's the principle behind it. So, you know, that's right. I mean, you might still be getting a few more dollars, but you're not keeping up with the cost of living or with inflation, and that's what this does.
Because the reason I bring that up is a lot of people say, well, you know, we're not actually cutting spending. We're spending the same amount of money we did last year. I go, yeah, but there's a difference. There's this thing called inflation that, you know, over time will eat away that investment and make it smaller. Just a thought. And I think there's an education process that has to go along with that. That when you're slowing the rate of keeping up with inflation, it's actually a benefit cut. It's actually a cut, not just to granny and me when I retire, but also to the community and the businesses that we spend that money in.
Oh, there's no question about it. You know, when people have less to live on, they spend less on the things that create jobs. You know, if you have a disabled person or a retired person living on Social Security who loses, and this, by the way, the other thing that I want to point out is that, you know, economists are used to talking in terms of quote-unquote real dollars, and most folks are, and I understand that, but when you start talking about how much you would lose under this plan, you know, it's close to $5,000 by the time you're 75 if you retire at 65. It's close to, it's a lot more than that as you start to approach 85, and so they know that, and, you know, over the lifetime of, if you live to be 85 and you've lost $13,000 or whatever, that's $13,000 that you didn't have to spend on presents for your kids. And somebody, I used to have that job myself in a warehouse stacking boxes of toys. Somebody doesn't have my job because of that. You take, you know, you take all the people on Social Security and take that money away from them. That's less toys for the grandkids. That's less jobs for warehouse workers like I was. And, you know, you multiply that by every groceries and, you know, high, you know, restaurant workers and anybody you can name really, somebody's losing out. Bus drivers and those kinds of folks, somebody's losing out when people don't have the money to spend, and this leaves them with less money to spend.
So let me ask you this, because one of the things that it's just infuriating me about this, I would understand if Mitt Romney were the guy who was saying this is what we need to do, or Paul Ryan or any of the Republicans, but a Democrat coming out and saying, you know, we're willing to slow the rate of increase, we're willing to cut benefits in Social Security, which I think, and maybe it's just I've got this view of what a Democrat should be. Social Security should be one of those things that I believe it's sacrosanct. That's the last club out of the bag. That's the last thing you go after. And yet this seems to be what's been on the table all along. You remember there were 2 years, I think it was 2 years, where there's no INCOLA increase. There was no increase going forward, which I was saying then is a benefit cut. So, you know, when I look at this, I got a real problem with this being Obama. I would expect it from Romney. I would expect it from the Republicans, just not from a Democrat.
Well, you know, look, that clip that you played of Obama saying he agrees with Romney on Social Security, they walked that back so quickly it would make your head spin, and they sent Joe, and Joe Biden had gone out there also during the campaign and said, no way, you can take it to the bank, they are not going to cut Social Security in any way, shape, or form. He said that to some people in a coffee shop in Virginia, and you know what, they quickly, you know, he let slip what he had been planning to do for a long time, and I know that from off-the-record conversations with some of his people, but, you know, they ran on one platform, they're governing on another, and they're saying that, the Republicans are making us do this. Well, it's not in the Republican budget. It's in the White House budget.
Yeah,
it's in the Democratic budget.
I was going to ask you, because what I'm hearing is saying, what they're saying is, well, we have to compromise. We have to find some measure of compromise. And one, I don't see the Republicans compromising on anything. I've looked at the Ryan budget. It's the same budget they put out a couple of years ago, the one they wrote the book on. It's the same one that they ran the 2012 presidential campaign on. It's basically the exact same thing. I don't see compromise. What I do see is I see Obama throwing this on the table, saying, see, I'm willing to compromise. I'm sorry, I'm just not getting it.
Well, it's even worse than that. You know, he gets together with the Republicans and he says, you know, I'll cut these entitlements. And they say, well, great, we like that. Why don't you propose it? Then he proposes it. And I had written saying, you know, they're going to turn around and they're going to use this against the Democrats politically, just like they did in 2010 and took the House of Representatives back by doing it. And I was just thinking to myself, I wonder how long it's going to take them to betray him on that, which they both agree on. 15 minutes. That's how long it took. 15 minutes after the president's announcement, the head of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee went on TV and said this was a shocking assault on our seniors.
Nope.
So it's just politically just as lame as it is economically.
And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, how often, you know, it's like, you know, like the kid who keeps getting kicked. How often do you throw this out there? Do you reach your hand across the aisle to have it, to have sand thrown in your face? Because every time he does this, he gets bitten. And there's part of me that believes that he really doesn't want to take the House back in 2014. There's part of me that thinks that, you know, they don't want it, because that's the only thing I can come up with doing this, because it's not going to pass. First and foremost, it's not, but throwing it out there gives that the Republicans an attack and ticks people like me off at Democrats who would be willing to even suggest it first and foremost as one of the first things out of the box.
Well, this is why I think, look, he doesn't have to run again, you know, and previous Democratic presidents have, you know, Jimmy Carter being an exception, but, you know, Clinton or whomever, you know, he's done very well, as many politicians have, you know, with the hedge fund world and all that. So I don't think Obama's thinking about elections anymore, which is why, yes, we have to pressure him on this one with phone calls, but we really have to let our senators and our representatives know that you need to get out in front of this, particularly if they're Democrats. You need to get out in front of this and say, I oppose this. I think it's a terrible idea. I'm going to fight for our seniors. I will buck the president on this one. We've got to hear, you know, the Congressional Caucus has put out letters and so on. Senate voted on it, but it was just a voice vote. I want both my senators, who are Democrats, to be on record saying we oppose this. I want my representative, who's a Democrat, to be on record saying, no, I will not vote for a budget that includes this. Period. End of story. I want that not just because it's such a horrible policy. I want that because I don't want to see the Republicans win even more seats in 2014 and maybe the presidency in 2016.
No, look, I understand you're not running for re-election, but look, you've still got a long time in your term. It'd be nice to be able to actually get something done. And to me, throwing this out there is basically saying, well, I just want to have political bickering for the next 3.5 years.
Right. Well, I whatever he do, there's going to be political bickering. I mean, the Republicans are going to fight him tooth and nail on everything. So, you know, why not fight for the right causes?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, the aggravating thing about this White House for me is that it can't even lose right. You know, I mean, if you know you're not going to get anything except a showdown and a fist fight, then, you know, go in there and put up a good fight. You know, don't just throw your hands down and let them knock you around the room, you know, which is what they're doing, maybe because, well, I personally think because this is the outcome they want, but I think that whatever the reason, we got to get, hey, Harry Reid used to be a prize fighter on top. Well, act like a prize fighter, you know, throw your hands up and fight this thing. And same thing for the folks in the Democrats in the House. Let's see some scrapping here because, you know, Elizabeth Warren's gotten out in front of this and a couple other folks. Let's see all the Democrats say, no, Mr. President, this is a bad idea.
Yeah, I've said that for a long time, that, you know, white working class males like me, we want to see somebody who's willing to stand up and take a punch and throw a punch, somebody who's not going to back down, you know, someone that you want in a street fight with you, somebody who you want by your side, not someone who's going to blind you with facts and a whole bunch of verbiage, but someone who's actually going to go to the mat for you. And now is that time. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Richard Eskow. He's written a great piece, 10 Chain CPI Facts the White House Doesn't Want You to Know, over at the Our Future blog, ourfuture.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Richard's name. You write in the piece that this is actually, while being a benefit cut, as we've talked about, that this is a tax cut as well. Can you explain that? Or, I mean, a tax hike.
The way
as
it works is that this CPI adjustment, the cost, you know, the consumer price index, they call it, that's how they calculate inflation. Now, when you move from one tax bracket to another, that's what's used to decide what the next higher tax bracket is. So if you're going from 25,000 to, you know, the next bracket up, let's say it's 28,000, this is what decides whether it should be 29,000. You know, this is how those numbers are calculated. So if you slow that process down too, then your salary increase, whether or not it's keeping up with inflation, you're going to get popped into a higher tax bracket earlier. So that means everybody's taxes are going to go up more quickly as a result of the change CPI, except income that's all the way at the top, 400,000 and above. That's at the top rate, so that doesn't move anyway. So net effect of this is a tax increase on everybody but the most wealthy. They get a little tax increase on the first day to 400, but a billionaire sees almost no change.
Right.
But the rest of us are going to see a change at the same time that we – so, and the way it works is – the way they calculate it is if you can't afford to buy – tuna fish anymore, so you start eating crackers and cheese, the way they want to do it is, okay, let's take tuna fish out, because nobody can afford tuna fish anymore. Well, now you can't afford tuna fish and you're paying higher taxes. That's the way the change CPI would work, and you get less money if you get disabled or when you try to retire. That's what they're trying to push down the American people's throats with this thing.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the one of the best ways of fixing this is getting rid of the high-wage loophole. These folks at the very top who are making all of this money, who are paying just a small percentage in Social Security tax. I like the lift the cap idea, but my frame on it is get rid of that high-wage loophole. Get rid of the gambling loophole on Wall Street. Get rid of that stuff.
Well, sure. I mean, there are a bunch of things. That is a good way to put it, that it's a loophole, because the fact is, look, you know, the wealthy in this country are making so much more of the national income than they ever were before. That's the only reason why 20 years from now there's some imbalance in Social Security's books, because they're taking all the money and they're not paying the payroll tax on it. So if they're going to take all the money, they better pay the payroll tax on it.
I mean, you keep throwing this out there, you know, that there's this problem. Everyone says, oh, there's a problem. There's a huge problem. Social Security, one, doesn't contribute at all to our deficit. And the problems that we do have, while I think are fairly minor, could be fairly easily fixed, right?
Well, with Social Security, absolutely. You could, lifting that cap or getting rid of that billionaire loophole, however you want to call it, that would be one way to do it. And by the way, they did a poll. Most Americans want to see Social Security benefits increased, because when you compare it to other developed countries like Europe or Canada, they're lousy already, and would be willing to pay more in taxes for it. So you could lift that loophole, add a few pennies on a week to our taxes or our employer's taxes. You could put that financial transaction tax on Wall Street, because the other reason, the only other reason Social Security is any kind of long-term problem is because Wall Street threw so many people out of work. And when they're out of work, they're not contributing to Social Security. They're not paying Social Security tax. And guess what? That's a benefit cut, too. If I have to spend 4 years out of work, that lowers my benefit when I retire, because that changes the way my benefit is calculated. So the guys who created the problem, let them pay to fix it.
Yeah, I'm with you. And so instead of talking about, and we've spent the last 10 or 12 minutes talking about chain CPI, instead of talking about this thing and going after Social Security, why not... Oh, I don't know, a jobs bill. Get people back to work so that they get higher wages and they pay into the system. That would kind of fix things, I think. An actual jobs bill, an actual a government that had full employment policy on the mind instead of, well, what we've been shoveled the last several years?
Oh, that's crazy talk, Rick.
Yeah, I know.
No, that's an absolute, of course we, I mean, look, from any kind of like common sense perspective, once in a while I just got to hit reset on my brain after I've been looking at this all week and just say, look, what would a sane person be talking about right now? What would a sane country be talking about right now with the worst long-term unemployment in modern history, with the highest official unemployment, for long term that we've seen in a long time, with the worst underemployment where people can only work part time, on and on, with the worst employment statistics we've seen in modern history, with the highest poverty levels in 50 years, on and on and on. We're talking about a deficit that's already shrinking rapidly, quote unquote, according to Goldman Sachs, instead of putting people back to work, and we're throwing Social Security into that deficit talk, even though it doesn't contribute to the deficit. This is the insanity that you get when corporate interests control politics and affect the way think tanks operate and influence the media and all these other things. It is absolute insanity to be talking about anything except, oh, and by the way, our infrastructure is falling down all around us. Bridges unsafe, highways unsafe, schools, asbestos in the buildings. And we're talking about this, when we could be putting people to work, fixing our infrastructure, educating our kids, delivering our mail, doing all the things we need to do. We're talking about cutting those things, and we're not talking about putting people back to work, and we're talking about the deficit, running around screaming like our hair is on fire when it's our third most important problem, fifth most important problem, tenth most important problem economically right now.
Yeah, jobs, that's the bottom line. The thing that the Republicans told us in 2010 they were going to focus on, yet I guess they lost their pledge. They must have lost the paperwork somewhere. Just lost
they didn't lose their jobs, though, so I guess they focused on keeping theirs.
Well, a good, excellent point. Richard Eskow, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you. Great piece, 10 chain CPI facts the White House doesn't want you to know. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. You can also get it at ourfuture.org. Richard, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rock. Keep up the good fight.
All righty. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
All they want to do is
Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Our stat of the day comes from the folks at the Too Much Online blog. They point out that among the world's 34 major industrial nations, the country of Denmark last year had the highest top marginal tax rate, a rate of 60.2% on incomes over, hold on to your hats, $55,000 a year. That's right, 60.2% on anything over 55 grand a year. The top rate here in the United States last year, 35%, went up to, 39.6? Just a little bump. People in California who saw their rate go up a little bit, the highest rate combined with the state and the federal, 47.6 on incomes over 400,000. Stop and think about this for a minute. Can you hear crazy right wingers going ballistic? If someone had the audacity, the dare, the unmitigated gall to suggest that we have a tax rate to emulate that of Denmark, I could see riots in the streets. But understand what they have in Denmark. Denmark has a debt to GDP ratio of about 44%. The U.S. we're about 75%. Debt to GDP ratio. We're not Greece, who had several hundred percent debt to GDP ratio, but we're not as good as Denmark. The other part of this is you look at universal health care. In Denmark, everyone gets health care. Everyone has the same health care system. Everyone's in it. They have a small private market. If you want you want above and beyond, you want plastic surgery, you want other things, it's there for the very wealthy, but virtually everybody is in the public system, in the universal system, run by them, run by the people. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world and have much worse outcomes in virtually every category than the people in Denmark. And why is that? Well, it's because they invest in that. They also have universal education, pre-K through college. And lifelong learning, job training, things like this, improve your skills as you move on through life, because they believe in education. It's not like here. And this is one of those things that, you know, you wake up and you go, okay, well, why are we paying all these taxes? Why such a high rate? Well, because you get all of these things that's good for society. And look, I get the whole idea of, oh, it's about me and I don't care about anybody else but me. And that's great if you're out in the desert or if you're in a field somewhere by yourself. But when you're part of a nation, and they love to throw this out, you know, one nation under God, yet they kind of forget all of the things that the Bible tells us. You know, if you look at it as Thomas Jefferson did, as an amazing piece of philosophy and a good way to lead your life based on philosophy, the whole argument, if you want to make one that, you know, the atheists make, fine, but I'm talking about pure philosophy. You live by rules. Do unto others. Or at least the silver rule. Don't do to somebody anything that you wouldn't want them to do back at you. But you look at these investments. What we've done in this country is we've saddled the next generation with $1.1 trillion in student loan debt. They don't do that in Denmark. We have some 50 million people uninsured, some 100 million people underinsured. And the vast majority of people, understand, if you're insured right now and you have a long-term critical illness that ends up costing you the job that you had, you no longer have insurance. Then you end up on the back of the taxpayer, which then you got problems. Because in order to get that, you got to be broke. You got to be basically indigent. And I look at other countries who, you know, they get it. They're not. Now they're trying to do what we've done here. Their wealth class looks at the American wealth class and goes, "Gee, how'd you do that? How'd you pull that off? How'd you get the people to give up on unemployment? How'd you get the people to give up on labor unions? How'd you get the people to give up on Social Security? How'd you get them to do that?" Well, we brainwashed them. We bought our way into the colleges and had veto power over the economics department, and we trained them. We put it in their head that, you know, you don't need laws. You don't need any of that stuff. Competition, free markets. And they've really done this in the South, and they've done it masterfully. And I remember when I took the kids down to Disney, I had a number of these conversations with people from the South who were saying, well, you know, if the country needs to get back on its feet, more competition, less regulations, lower taxes. Like it was, you know, in just the automated response, you know, the... like blinking, it's lower regulations, less taxes, less regulation, more competition. just beaten into them from day one. You know, we don't need rules, which is why you saw every Republican vote against the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would have said, hey, you know what, if a man and a woman do the same job, they should be paid the same. Now, me personally, I look at this and I go, well, you know the best way to have a Paycheck Fairness Act? I mean, if I'm a woman, I got to be honest, I'm amazed that there's not a mass movement of women joining a women's union, saying, you know what, we demand that we be paid the same as men, and we're going to collectively come together and demand that. Call it whatever you want. Call it a union, call it an organization, call it an association, call it whatever you want. But it's still working people coming together saying, you know what, we demand some of the wealth that we create. Seems reasonable. But you've got an entire political party, the Republicans, dead set against that, and some Democrats, too. There were some Democrats that voted against it as well. But I look at this, and actually, there were no Democrats in the House that voted against it. There will be in the Senate, trust me, if it gets that far. What I find interesting, though, is Virginia Fox yesterday said that it's a, you know, the bill, this Paycheck Fairness Act, it's a liberal plot. It's a liberal conspiracy. It's the liberals trying to get people to think that Republicans are anti-woman. And, you know, I've yet to find anybody who's going to make the argument that, well, they're not. Because everything that they've done has pointed them in that direction. And for me, you know, you look at the same thing, you know, this whole push towards, and this, it's coming. It's working its way through the committees right now. This something euphemistically called the Working Families Flexibility Act, which basically is going to give companies the ability to work you as long as they want without paying any overtime. And then they'll just trade you off with time when they don't need you. Under the guise of you're going to have flexibility. And the flexibility is not going to be for you. You're not going to be able to choose. Think about that for a second. You're not going to be able to choose, you know, little Johnny's sick. I'd like to use some comp time, please. Well, we got work to do. But little Johnny's sick, tough. Hire a babysitter. Am I wrong? And what's going on in this country is this push, this assault on workers' rights, and this whole push to creating Desperation Nation. So we can go back to the days of Dickens. Now, the Christmas Carol lived in real time. And I look at this story in Ohio. There was a report put out by the ACLU that pointed out that, you know, if you get into trouble in Ohio, let's say you got a ticket, you got a DUI, whatever. You had something where you ended up having to pay a fine. They found that, and not just in Ohio, but in a lot of states, they found that, you know, people who couldn't afford to pay the fines ended up going to jail. And in fact, some of the findings found that one in every five bookings in one of the counties in Huron County in Ohio, one in five of the people going to jail involved them not paying fines. They didn't have the money. They're broke. The economy's in the tank. They're broke. They told the story of one woman who was taken to jail. Each and every time she couldn't make her $50 a month payment because she had written some bad checks. And she, you know, went to court. They found her guilty, and they sentenced her to, you know, you're going to pay $50 a month. So she was unable to pay it, and they put her in jail every month. Another guy couldn't pay his fine for driving with a suspended license. He went to jail for 10 days, couldn't pay the $300 fine. You look at this and you go, how is that good for us? And they go through a whole bunch of these different scenarios where people are broke and we're locking them up. And you know what? It's good for business. That way, we can feed the prison industry. I've been saying it for a while. I'm waiting for it. The return of debtors' prisons, here we are. Amazing. Let's take a quick break. When we come back and talk with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
1, 2, 3, 4. Hey, John Kasich, don't tell us about.
Smith Show.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America, but he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
All right, you know, for all of you who went through college like I did with the very meager budget, the ramen noodles kind of budget, you'll be very happy. College student in the UK, the Isle of Wight, 18-year-old girl Georgia Redmond, she refuses to eat anything but ramen-style noodles. In fact, the 5'3", 98-pound woman has, according to her reports, has eaten 40,000 miles of ramen noodles. Doctors say she's got the internal organs of an 80-year-old. So I guess, you know, while it may be tasty, probably killing you. Anyway, let's find out what's going around and around the world in Washington, D.C. I got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, ramen noodle?
No. Think I'll pass. Just thinking that way.
Okay. Well, all right. So
I'm just leaning, passing.
There you go. Nothing on the noodle front. How about on the North Korea front? I understand Jay Carney had some statements about North Korea today.
Well, he did, and he had to make them because a Republican member of Congress in an intelligence committee hearing yesterday that they were 3 hours into blurted out that the Defense Intelligence Agency thought that there was moderate confidence that North Korea has the ability to launch a nuclear attack. And that became the lead story worldwide.
Yeah.
The White House decided, well, we think we're going to put out our own story about this. And they said the Pentagon is our assessment that North Korea has not demonstrated the capability to deploy a nuclear-armed missile. Because I think it's interesting that they disagree with their own Defense Intelligence Agency, which, by the way, was a big toter of Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapon.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, interesting. So
it's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, but here again, I keep hearing people saying, well, you know, we're seeing the same forces rattling the sabers, you know, saying that, hey, let's go play over in the North Korean sandbox. I'm not thrilled with this idea.
No, I don't think anybody's terribly thrilled. I mean, there may be a few belligerent ones who are thrilled, but I don't get the impression that the administration wants to play in that sandbox. I mean, John Kerry, who's in South Korea, he's going to China and Japan next, is warning Pyongyang that it would be a provocative and unwanted act to fire a medium-range missile, and also saying Kim Jong-un needs to understand, as I think he probably does, what the outcome of a conflict would be. Our hope is we can get back to talks.
Right. Or make China put their little brother in line.
Yeah, that's the other option, which we have reached out to China to do, and we'll also be doing more of when Kerry's in China, of course.
I understand yesterday the president met with the UN Secretary General and basically just cut it out.
Well, he did. Now, he said it in polite diplo speak.
Diplo speak, I like that.
Yeah, he said it in diplo speak, but effectively, I mean, that's basically... that's the equivalent of what he said. He said North Korea must end the kind of belligerent approach they've been taking, and he said the United States will take all necessary steps to protect its people and to meet our obligations and our allegiances in the region. That means cut it out.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, I mean, because I keep hearing the calls for us to arm the rebels in Syria. Anybody in North Korea we could arm? I mean, because, you know, we do that around the world. We go, here's a bunch of guns. Go do something.
No, there's really nobody in North Korea we can arm because you're dealing with a cult.
Okay. Good point.
And it's difficult to arm cult members until they've been deprogrammed.
Yeah, they found the unicorn, I guess, right?
Yes.
That evidently their fearless leader, their founder, rode in on or something. If I remember
I
the story
really
right.
I don't understand it.
Yeah, I don't either. But on the Syrian front, I understand there's a heavy push towards arming the rebels there. John McCain asking, you know, how many people are going to have to die?
Oh, yeah. No, he really is ready. He's ready to do it. And yet it's interesting, the al-Nusra Front, which is one of the leading jihadist groups who's been having some of the biggest successes, actually, against the Assad regime, just this week came out and said, well, we're declaring our allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda. And so the Free Syrian Army sort of went, okay, and we're sort of distancing ourselves from you, except we'll continue to work with you.
Uh-huh.
So, and then people wonder why the administration is leery of arming the rebels.
See, I'm leery of getting involved in any of that stuff, because it always seems to turn around and bite us right in the behind, no matter what it is we do.
It's very tricky stuff. These things are never straightforward. There's always wheels and wheels and wheels.
I mean, you go back to, you know, to Hussein, you go back to Gaddafi, a lot of all of them, we kind of helped put them there. Bin Laden, you know, we were instrumental in all of that.
It's very complicated.
Yeah. Let's move back home. Immigration plan, I guess next week we're going to hear something.
Yes, the Gang of Eight in the Senate plans to make its announcement on Tuesday. That is the current plan. And various bits have leaked out. One thing that's come out is that there's going to be a cutoff date. Anybody who's arrived here after the 31st of December would not be eligible for citizenship or for applying for legal status or potentially citizenship. They had to come up with a cutoff date. Democrats were pushing for the date to be as current as possible, like January the 1st, 2013. Senator Marco Rubio wanted an even earlier cutoff than the date they settled on, so they December the 31st, 2011 was the compromise.
Oh, 2011.
A lot of people are going to be disappointed.
So how do you then figure that out? I mean, who's to say, well, I was here before, you just didn't find me?
Got to prove it.
Yeah, okay. Because I was going to say, if it was December 31st of this year, well, there's still time to, you know, to come across the border, and maybe we would see a mass influx then. But all right, 2011. Yeah, I don't know if you saw Marco Rubio going to be making the rounds this weekend, the Sunday Talking Head programs. He's on every one of them.
Yes, he's doing the rounds. He's doing the game shows.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what comes out of his mouth.
He's interesting because he tries to be careful, and yet he still says stuff.
I can't wait to see what stuff he says. Also, the Keystone Bill. Well, there's a vote on this coming up?
Yeah, the House GOP is going to advance the Keystone Pipeline Bill next week. This is a bill to approve construction of the pipeline. They basically want to go around the president. They want to... And it's got some support from some conservative Democrats, by the way, too. They just want to bring up, have a bill passed so that they don't have to have the whole thing approved by the State Department and then by the president. So they can just have a law saying, we're having a Keystone Pipeline and that's the end of it.
Yeah, I'm not against building it. I'm against using it. I'm not against building stuff. Let's build all kinds of stuff. My problem is that no one's proved to me that by having all this dirty oil coming through our country, it's going to benefit us really at all. And, you know, I look at this latest spill, this Exxon spill. I guess it's in Arkansas. Well,
yeah.
I guess I don't know if it's in Arkansas because we're not allowed to know. None of our media people are allowed there. I guess they've been threatened with arrest for anyone who tries to go in.
Right. That's right. You're threatened with arrest by the sheriff's department.
So I'm a reporter, and I want to know what's going on so I can report it. I'm going to be arrested. Isn't there something constitutional that protects? I mean, the only job in this country that's protected constitutionally is the press, right?
Yes.
So we're going to arrest them now.
I mean, it's quite astonishing. This isn't the first spill this has happened at. This happens at oil spills. The oil companies do this.
Well, we see who has the power. And this is my problem with building this damn thing. I'm not against building things. I'd love to build huge things. In fact, I'm a big supporter of building a fence on the borders, on both borders. In fact, all around the country, big fences. Not that they stop anything. Build 30-foot fences so we can have a 31-foot ladder industry. Build huge things so we can, you know, we can have shovels and all that stuff. It's called getting people back to work. I'm in favor of building. Lots of stuff.
But there's a but.
And?
What's your but?
Well, the but is it doesn't work. I mean, the fence doesn't work. The pipeline is not going to help us. But I'm not against building.
Understood.
It's that simple. Our friends in the House, I guess they voted to freeze the National Labor Relations Board.
Yeah. No, I thought you'd enjoy this one, or not. Yeah, they voted. It was a really tight vote, 219 to 209. Every Democrat voted against it, and 10 Republicans did too. Basically, they've frozen the national in the House, the National Labor Relations Board. It's to do two things. They're freezing the work of the board as it is currently constituted, and they're blocking enforcement of the decisions the board's made since President Obama's appointments have been put in place.
Right.
Because they were recess appointed, and the Federal Appeals Court said that the appointments were unconstitutional. So they're basically jumping ahead of the Supreme Court and putting legislation in place before there's been a Supreme Court decision.
No surprise here. I mean, it's what the Republicans have done his entire term. And, you know, the Senate didn't have to pass anything. They've just not approved any of the nominees, basically rendering the Labor Relations Board unable to do anything. And when Obama did what I thought he should have done sooner, I mean, I would have done the exact same thing. Now they want to go back and undo all that. And what's it doing to labor relations in this country?
I don't think it really helps labor relations terribly.
Well, what it does is it puts all the power into the hands of the employers and the very wealthy to impose their will on the rest of us, which is why you see falling wages and you see benefits being lost and you see our economy not recovering as quickly as it should, because the wealth that's being created is trickling upward. So much for that trickle-down nonsense. And finally, ding-dong, the witch is dead. What's that about?
Well, this is really a fascinating story. In England, they have a top 40, a singles top 40.
Mm-hmm.
And from time to time, there are pushes by the citizenry to get a song in and to make it number one. This happened a few years ago with trying to defeat Simon Cowell at Christmas, and they won with Rage Against the Machine. So, you know, Brits are big into this. Well, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, the 51-second song from The Wizard of Oz in 1939, is currently at number 4 in the BBC Top 40, and it's scheduled to shoot up to number 3 on Sunday.
Wow.
Should it be played on Radio 1, the BBC radio station? It's a big debate. Why? Because it's an anti-Thatcher song.
Okay.
It's part of an anti-Thatcher campaign to dance on her grave by people who hate her.
Yeah.
And there have been moves by Thatcher friends, Thatcher fans, a lot of people saying this is unseemly, she's not even in the ground. This is a state-run broadcaster. It is not befitting to play this song at all. It should be banned. The BBC have banned many songs. This must be banned. Other people, including the DJ, the very influential DJ, other people say it must be played. The chart is a statistical reality that shouldn't be editorialized.
I agree.
So they are making a compromise, which I think is appalling.
They're going to play it backwards.
They know they're going to play a clip as part of a news report and explain it.
Huh? What the hell is that?
Yeah.
This is where you allow the PC people too much power.
Yeah. Nevertheless, what's good news is for those who hate Margaret Thatcher is that Ding Dong the Witch is Dead is number three. It's shooting up the charts with this kind of publicity. It may be number one by the time of her funeral.
Yeah, and you know the whole. I generally find that to be the case. The more stink you put up, the more resistance that the powers to be put forward, the more people want it.
Yeah,
it's kind of like when I was a kid. The more my mother said no, the more I did it.
You are a perfect example, sir.
I get it. And in fact, I understand the whole dancing on people's graves. There's some nuns that I had when I was a young man that I'm keeping tabs on.
I bet there are.
Evil.
And
evil.
They're keeping tabs on you, too.
I hope so. Evil, evil people. Anyway, so good news. Good. Victoria, always great talking with you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth, sky.
Today, what causes the aurora borealis or northern lights?
Some Inuit believed the spirits of their ancestors could be seen dancing in the flickering lights. In Norse mythology, the aurora was a fire bridge to the sky built by the gods.
But science tells us the aurora happens because of the sun. Storms on the sun send gusts of charged solar particles hurling across space. If Earth is in the path of the particle stream, our planet's magnetic field and atmosphere react. When the charged particles from the sun strike atoms and molecules in Earth's atmosphere, they cause them to become excited.
Atoms consist of a central nucleus and a surrounding cloud of electrons. When charged particles from the sun strike atoms in Earth's atmosphere, electrons move to higher energy orbits further away from the nucleus. Then, when an electron moves back to a lower energy orbit, the atoms release light.
And that's what causes an aurora. What happens is similar to what happens in neon signs. Electricity is used to excite the atoms and gases within the glass tubes of these signs. That's why these signs give off their brilliant colors. Oxygen causes the color green. Nitrogen causes blue or red colors. The aurora works on the same principle, but at a far more vast scale.
For more, come to earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Republicans are saying if we have any gun laws, if we do anything on background checks, we do any of that stuff, it's going to lead to genocide, just like Rwanda, according to South Carolina Republican Jeff Duncan, says anything, we do any of this stuff, it's going, background checks, any of this stuff, it's going to lead exactly to what happened in Rwanda. And you go, really? We're going to be Rwanda? You know, and I love listening to these Republicans tell me we're going to be like Greece, and now we're going to be like Rwanda.
fear-mongering on steroids. I mean, it's to compare our country to a country where some million people were slaughtered. We've really fallen off the beaten path here. And now you also see in Texas, one of the Texas regulators, someone put on, appointed by Rick Perry. He has been appointed to several positions. He tweeted out a picture of a noose. And again, you know, it's in Texas, you know, a whole different ball game. A picture of a noose and the names of all of the Republicans who voted for the Toomey Mansion bill. The little picture says, here are 16 Republicans who just moments ago voted with Feinstein and Schumer and Reid to advance Obama's gun control bill. Even though it was Toomey and Manchin. But, you know. But there it is. The word treason with a noose. So, you know, you gotta wonder, you know, what exactly are our Republican friends saying? Not good stuff. In Missouri, they're pushing through a piece of legislation, and I love this. This is a beautiful way of going about it. If you're a private business owner and you say, you know what, I don't want people with guns in my business. I don't want my employees to carry guns. I worked for a company that said you could not under any circumstances carry a firearm on any company vehicle. Well, what this piece of legislation that was introduced by a Republican in Missouri says, if you're a private business and you say that, then you're responsible for whatever injuries happen to the person. If someone comes in and shoots someone on your property, some crazy person or, you know, just a robber or whatever, and you didn't allow that other person to have a gun with them, you're liable. The flip side of this is if you say, yes, carry your gun, bring your gun to my business. Yes, bring your gun to daycare with you. And someone shoots you, you're completely off the hook. No, nothing whatsoever can happen. Nothing whatsoever. And you look at this and you go, exactly, you know, how insane have we gotten? I mean, this gun debate has really taken some very bizarre twists and turns. And I look in Cumberland County, where I live. You've got the school district in Cumberland County saying, you know what, on Election Day, we don't want to have people coming to the school on Election Day. The Camp Hill School Board, the claim is they're considering a proposal to prevent the district's high school from being one of the borough's polling stations. And I guess it's going to end up, and there's part of me that goes, this is one of the people who, we should be doing more stuff into churches. Because this is where it's going to end up. It's going to go from the school, which is a public building where you do your voting, to a private church, which is kind of backwards, I think. And as one of the people quoted in the article says, it's kind of backwards. We should be taking this out of the churches and putting it into public spaces because it is for the public good. And I'm kind of on board with that. But we've really gotten into some very bizarre worlds. Anyway, if you've missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to download our podcast. You can take it anywhere with you. Take it on the go with the Stitcher app. Again, thanks for listening. Time to get involved, time to get active, time to get engaged. This week's meetings are adjourned. Let's get to work.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial mystery.